no clothes to wear.
We went through so much pain, so much hardship.
A new episode of 3 Million on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds this Thursday morning at 9:30.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 24th of August. This is Alan Smith. Good morning. Three people have been stabbed to death in an apparently random attack in the western German city of Solingen. Eight others were wounded, five of them seriously. They'd been attending a festival in the city centre. Police are still hunting for the suspect, as James Reid reports.
The attack happened in a central square where bands were playing, as Solingen marked its 650th anniversary. Witnesses told German media that passers-by were stabbed at random. A huge manhunt is underway to find the attacker, who's not been identified. Roads have been blocked and residents told to stay indoors. The mayor of Solingen said the city was in a state of shock, horror and grief. He said he was praying for those still fighting for their lives.
Donald Trump has been joined on stage at his latest campaign rally by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., hours after he abandoned his attempt to run for the White House as an independent candidate. Mr. Kennedy, the nephew of John F. Kennedy, endorsed the former president after admitting that he had no realistic path to victory. At last night's rally in Arizona, Mr. Trump welcomed his new backer and called him brilliant.
For the past 16 months, Bobby has run an extraordinary campaign. His candidacy has inspired millions and millions of Americans, raised critical issues that have been too long ignored in this country, and brought together people from across the political spectrum in a positive campaign, grounded in the American values of his father, Robert Kennedy, a great man.
The television presenter Jermaine Genus, who was sacked by the BBC this week, has said he's deeply sorry for sending inappropriate messages to female colleagues on The One Show. He told The Sun newspaper that he was ashamed but had not done anything illegal. The body set up to provide compensation to victims of the infected blood scandal has been given the power to start making payments. 30,000 people were infected with HIV and hepatitis C, and some groups are unhappy with the amounts on offer. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
After a campaign lasting decades, a public inquiry concluded in May that doctors, governments and the NHS had repeatedly failed victims. Now the Infected Blood Compensation Authority has been formally set up. The Hepatitis C Trust said people had waited too long, though it was welcome that the new body had been established at long last. But the Trust went on to say there were still concerns at the disparities in the proposed compensation for people with hepatitis viruses and HIV. A government spokesperson said advice on compensation payments had come from an expert advisory group.
Prosecutors in Sicily are expected to outline the initial findings of their investigation into the sinking of the superyacht Bazian this morning. Seven people died when the vessel went down during a storm off the coast of the island on Monday. Those killed included British tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch and his daughter Hannah. The Paralympic flame will be lit at Stoke Mandeville in Buckinghamshire today. It'll then begin its journey to Paris, where the Paralympic Games are due to get underway on Wednesday. More details from our sports correspondent, Andy Swiss.
The flame will be lit by two British Paralympians, rower Helene Rainsford and wheelchair curler Gregor Ewan, as it starts its journey at the birthplace of the Paralympic movement. It was back in 1948 that Stoke Mandeville hosted the first competition for wheelchair athletes, an event which developed into the Paralympic Games. The flame will travel to France through the Channel Tunnel. When it arrives in Calais, it'll be split into 12 separate flames, which will then be taken around France. They'll eventually converge in Paris for the opening ceremony on Wednesday, where the Paralympic cauldron will be lit.
That's the BBC News. We'll take a look at the papers in a minute. But first, Elizabeth Rizzini is here with the weather.
Thank you, Alan. Well, Storm Lillian has pulled away, but it's a very wet start for many towards southern Wales, southern England, up through the Midlands, East Anglia, parts of Yorkshire. Cloudy outbreaks of rain this morning. Some of that rain likely to be heavy, and there is a localised weather warning in force across the southeast of England, parts of East Anglia too, where the rain is likely to be heavy. It's going to be pulling away as we head through the morning. Still some patches left for southeast England. England and East Anglia into the middle part of the afternoon. Sunny spells behind the front, but also some heavy thundery showers possible too. Now, for much of Northern Wales, Northern England and Scotland, sunny spells, possibly some heavy thundery showers. They'll be most frequent out towards the north and the west. Northern Ireland, again, sunny spells and some showers. It's pretty windy still in the northwest, with lighter winds developing elsewhere, but breezy still for the time of year. A brisk southwesterly, then westerly wind, and feeling cool too. Temperatures below par, 16 to 19 Celsius for England and Wales, 14 to 17 degrees for Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Now for a look at the morning papers, and several remain preoccupied with the 10% increase in the energy price cap announced yesterday. The Guardian reports that Keir Starmer is facing pressure from Labour backbenchers to extend financial support to vulnerable people this winter. It says MPs are warning that thousands could die because of a combination of the Household Support Fund ending in September and winter fuel payments being scrapped for many pensioners. An anonymous minister tells The Times the worry is that things are only going to get worse with the further cuts, and difficult decisions will have to be made due to the mess that was bequeathed to us. The Daily Mail's editorial says many pensioners this winter will be forced to choose between heating and eating. The Defence Secretary, John Healey, has told the Daily Telegraph that Russia's incursion into the Kursk region of Ukraine's incursion into the Kursk region of Russia has sown doubt in the minds of Russians about President Putin's leadership. In an article for the paper, Mr. Healey says the offensive has exposed Putin's Kremlin cabal to the consequences of their aggression. The Eye reports that a new problem is facing the £57 billion HS2 rail project. A large gap between the train's doors and station platforms means the trains are unsafe to use at 11 existing stops on the route. The Office of Rail and Road has said it has no current concerns about the HS2 rolling stock. And The Times reports that detailed plans have been drawn up for the day when the nation is informed of the passing of Larry, the Downing Street cat. Brought in from Battersea Cats and Dogs Home in 2011, Larry is on his sixth Prime Minister and is 17 years old. The paper reveals that the scheme is named Larry Bridges, a reference to the bridge code name given to royal death preparations. A government insider allays any fears about Larry's health in the article, saying he's doing OK now. And that's our look at the papers. This is BBC Radio 4, where we'll have Farming Today this week in a little under half an hour. But first, we're off for a spot of bird watching in Richmond Park in London, in open country.
It's Nadim Pereira. You are listening to BBC Radio 4, and this is Open Country. We are here in Richmond Park. The weather has definitely held out for us. What a beautiful place this is. And today we're going to be taking a deep dive into nature and wildlife, of course. But we've also got some footballers along with us, some young ballers that are going to be sharing some insights on their journey in the professional side of the game and how nature can possibly become a support structure that will help them along their way. Liam Jones, who has been under 18s at West Ham United Academy, and I'm also here with Manny Longello of Birmingham City Football Club. And just in the background, we can hear the calling of the jackdaws. The parakeets were calling earlier, and I'm going to say straight away, that's one of the things that fascinated me most about this park, the interactions between those two species, the parakeets and the jackdaws. My birding journey honestly properly started in this very park. I found myself outside of classical education, and while all my friends were in school, I would come to this massive patch of green that I saw on a map on Google. It's so big, the biggest green space in London by a long way. So today is me revisiting that chapter of my life, but also bringing in another passion of mine in the form of football. So in the years since then, I've become a youth football coach, and I've done that for 6 years. And I always try to teach my boys that nature is here for you as a resource. And two of the guests I'm here with today know a lot about pressure, and they're always in competition with their peers. And what we're doing here today is exploring what that looks like, what that means for the players themselves. But also we're looking at how nature can provide an outlet for these guys and perhaps become an essential tool that not only these players can use, but that clubs can utilize in maintaining the well-being of their players, particularly the young and developing players. I'm going to introduce a game to the two of our guests and play on their competitive nature. So here I've got a sheet, one for each of you boys. So there you go, Liam, that's your one. And Manny, that's your one. Why don't you just describe what you're looking at the moment, boys?
Just a bunch of birds.
A bunch of birds, right, that's right. What can you hear around you?
Birds.
Yeah. So you two are going to be in a friendly competition today. You've both got a pair of binoculars around your neck. You've both got a few species to spot. Look, Manny's on it straight away, trying to get that head start. So these species are species that are commonly seen throughout, but the ones that are worth more points are slightly harder to see. So at any point you think you've spotted something on that, jump right in and claim your points. Whoever wins by the end of the day wins Man of the Match. The first ever Radio 4 Man of the Match on Open Country.
I believe that's a crow.
I'm seeing that as a jackdaw.
Ooh, bingo, bingo. Liam. Liam's got the first points, Manny. You saw it first, but you got the ID right. That's 1-0, Liam. But it's a good start, boys. Good start. 1-0 to Liam. So I am here with Peter Lawrence, who is assistant manager of the entire park, which is over 2,500 acres. I'm also here with Emily McGee, who is chief communications officer. So, Peter, in terms of biodiversity, what is it that makes Richmond so special?
We're designated as a nature reserve. So that's our acid grassland, which is nationally rare. And it's also the veteran ancient trees. You can see we're coming up to a couple on the horizon here. Nice. Some of those predate when the park became a park, which became a sort of royal hunting ground about 800 years ago. The wall went up in around 1637, and before that it was open countryside. It was common. It's been green space for an incredibly long time, and it's been cared for and protected and managed as a green space for much of that time for hunting, so the deer were key, and obviously now it's become more important as a recreation space. The deer do a lot of the work here. They do a lot of the grazing of the grassland, browsing of the tree line, but it's more than that as well. It's about the hydrology of the site and the soils, how that maintains the habitats, and down to some of our smallest inhabitants there. So actually managing the grassland, almost as important as the deer, if not more, is the yellow meadow ant, the tiny organism that people would hardly ever know is present until you start seeing their anthills.
If meadow ants are so key to what you do, and it's something that you have to closely monitor, surely one of my favourites, the green woodpecker, is high on your watch list.
Yeah, certainly is. Yeah, because that will generally find that feeding on the ground in some of the more valuable areas of acid grassland, because that's where the anthills are. And those anthills give it the grassland that diversity. You get some really interesting mixes of wildflowers and insects just on the different side of a single anthill. And as you say, green woodpeckers, they love them. They're feeding in there, picking away at the yellow meadow ant. So that's certainly one of our sort of characteristic birds, if you like.
When I was about 15, again, was not in school, and I found myself in spaces like Richmond, in Essex, and I was sat down on a park bench, just trying to strategize, think my life through and try and make some better choices. And as I was having this train of thought, I just saw this bird land about 10 foot in front of me. And it was bright green with this red cap and black mask and really long, thick beak. And I'd never seen anything like it. It was so beautiful. And it came at a time where I thought nothing beautiful was to happen to me, frankly speaking. And I was taken by it. This bird couldn't have cared less. It was just there, sifting through the grass, looking for its ants. And it was that moment that really set it off for me, and I before I knew it, I was leaving my house looking for green woodpeckers, and then it became the kestrel, then it became the long-tailed tit, and then I was hooked. So I have a very, very special place in my heart, not only for this place, but also for the many, many green woodpeckers that it houses. Peter, a soundtrack to the summer is The Call of the Skylark. Now, in a nutshell, what can you tell us about the skylark?
It's a beautiful bird, it's a fantastic bird. It has that incredible song. We're so lucky to have a population here in Richmond Park, but they are a red listed bird, so that means that they're globally, they're endangered. And it's similar in Richmond Park. We have seen declines in our population, so we're doing what we can to maintain that population. They're ground nesting species, so they're very easily disturbed by people walking through, by if there's dogs off leads running around. So we have introduced a policy. We've got in Richmond Park, we've got three areas where now for the whole year we ask that people keep their dogs on leads in those areas and that people do their best to keep to the paths. Mm-hmm. And it's just to give those birds in these small areas of the park some breathing space.
Have you spotted anything, Manny?
I think I did spot a crow fly over.
Bro, I'm going to give you that. That is a crow.
That is a crow, 100%
right? A carrion crow.
Ah, I thought so.
There you go. How many points is that worth?
I think that's worth two.
That's worth two. Oh, Liam's face. Liam's face. Yes, Manny. So it's 2-1. Two birds off the list, boys. Off to a cracking start. So we've all been walking for about 20 minutes or so, maybe. And we're now coming to the lakes. What are the names of these lakes?
These are called pen ponds.
Pen ponds. We've spotted jackdaws. We've spotted carrion crows. To nature nerds like myself and Peter, nature is amazing. But to the everyday person, and moreover, to a lot of people from the communities that I grew up in, nature is quite boring. It's hard to get people into it. And a part of the strategy, a part of the tactics that I'm employing to change that narrative is to cross-pollinate nature with popular culture. So I've brought the boys out here today to do exactly that, to explore what nature can offer them as young players, but also as individuals. How can it benefit them? Do they have a connection to it already? Because something that's bothered me, boys, as a football coach of 6 years, was that none of the boys I coached had any connection to the wider ecosystem around them. And that's something I want to change, quite frankly. Have you guys ever stopped to appreciate the bird life in any of your training grounds?
No, I think in our training ground, you don't really get much wildlife.
You tend to see different types of birds, but for me, personally, I wouldn't identify them because, you know, I don't really know so much about them. Yeah. But being here and looking at the sheet of paper, I'm catching on to the name, so I think now going back to Birmingham, I'll be able to identify these birds.
Yeah, definitely. Pete, what would you say could be done to get more young people engaging and interacting with this space?
Our first objective is giving everyone opportunity to learn about what we have in the parks, about its nature, its history, its heritage. And we're putting particular focus into reaching out to young people and trying to help them understand the parks a bit more and have the opportunity to come in. So we run quite a few programs around that. One example is a project we've got called Exploring Urban Nature, which is it's a volunteer program really, aimed at young adults 16 to 21 and giving them the opportunity to come into the parks and get involved in some conservation activities, at the same time getting a chance to experience the nature in the parks, and a bit like we have today, just seeing how easy it is to just take a moment out and look around and understand the parks. And it's an introduction to that as a potential career path as well.
So these are the jackdaws attacking a crow. So jackdaws and crows are close cousins, but the jackdaws are a different species. So they don't really like the bigger crow being in their territory, so they're just chasing it all the way off.
Wow.
So a bit of beef just popped off right before our very eyes.
That's a bit fascinating, I'll be real. I never thought birds, you know, great at cracking like that, to be honest.
And what makes a crow so successful, and that's why you're seeing so many of them around, is because they're intelligent. They're super, super, super intelligent. They know how to work together. They vary their diet. They don't just rely on one food source. They change it up, which means if one food source goes down, they've always got a backup. Every night, they roost in something called communal roost. So, I don't know, a bit like if you guys, before and after a game, you have a social, right? To like wind down together as a team, team bonding. They pretty much do the same thing. In the morning, they'll set off in their groups. They have brethren in their group that they prefer to hang out with. And they set off foraging for the day and they come back, and amongst their close-knit groups in these big communal roosts, which can be thousands of birds at one time, they chat. They actually chat, and it's been documented by scientists that they share new spots. So if they find a new spot with a new source of food, they're sharing that information. And then the next morning, those same birds that chatted about the new stuff will go together and go and see that. So if you guys had to pick a bird that represents you as a player, what would you say you are?
I'd probably say a falcon.
What parallels do you think are between you and a falcon?
They're quite intelligent.
Yeah. They're sharp.
So if you think you're like a peregrine falcon or a falcon, you must be quick, boy. So Peter's actually pointed something out here.
So there's two birds swimming on pen ponds. A really beautiful bird, the great crested grebe. And there's a pair of them. There will be a partnership, and they actually do a little courtship dance together, where they kind of shake their heads at each other. They swim right opposite each other and get really close together.
Heads back on them. What are they? That's a good question, Liam. So we're looking at the other side of the pen ponds now, and that bird is called a coot. It's called a coot, and that's actually one you're probably going to see in any local park with a bit of water. Look, he's pulled the guide out to see if it's on the guide. It's actually not on the guide. But do you know what? Just for the enthusiasm to get another point, you've got a bonus point for that. He's got one. He's spotted a new species. Peter, have we lost the crested grebes?
I think they've gone right over to the edge of the lake, so they're diving down quite regularly, so they'll be fishing over there.
Yeah. No bonus point for the crested grebe, but a bonus point for the coot. Who is going to get that man of the match? Right. Honestly, I'm actually really, really impressed by both these boys and their enthusiasm to take an interest in the wildlife, but also to compete. They're doing really, really well. So we will get into the football now. So Manny, just talk us through your background in football.
Okay, so I started off playing football for fun with my brothers, just playing for fun in the parks. Back home, Tenji, barking. They're just having a laugh, you know, playing till the sun comes out, until the sun goes down. And then I started playing for a Sunday league team. And then from there, I got interest from three other academies, but I chose West Ham. Obviously, my brother was already been signed there. So, yeah, been at West Ham for 13 years.
13 years?
13 years. Where?
So, how old are you now, bro?
23.
How did you find it?
I mean, some of the best days of my life, to be honest, you know. I made some friendships for life, you know, learnt a lot under some great coaches, forever grateful for. I managed to make two appearances for the first team.
What's that like as a young player, so at such a young age?
I mean, obviously, I never got too ahead of myself because, obviously, in previous years, I've seen better academy players than me that who never got a chance to play in the team, or and when they did get a chance to play a team, they never really stuck around. So I always knew to just like take it as it comes, just be humble on the approach. And then that season I managed to get a loan out to Birmingham, and that's where my career really started for me, do you know? Mm-hmm. Ended up signing for Birmingham.
So yeah, you've now recently signed for Birmingham from West Ham, like you said, after being on loan. Mm-hmm. You've just broken in to first team football. That environment has got to be tough to function in. Mm. What's some of the best advice you've received from peers or from mentors about navigating this time?
Just take it as it comes, you know. You can't really predict anything too tough. So as long as you're ready for the worst and for the best, mm-hmm. you'll be all right. And always work hard, you know, always give it your best. You know, you're only as good as your last game, so...
Yep. Okay, so then we get to Mr. Liam Jones.
Yeah, so my dad was a footballer for West Ham, so I always grew up around being a West Ham fan. He owned his own Sunday league team, so I played under my dad for a couple of years. And then I had interest from quite a few clubs, but for me it was a no-brainer. I mean, I was so young at the age of six.
Wow.
And then, yeah, the journey is pretty simple from there. I've had my ups and downs at West Ham, obviously, like every footballer would. But, yeah, I've been there for the previous 12 years.
I think I need to highlight to the audience that Liam is 18 years old. What has helped you cope with those ups and downs?
Obviously, a big thing would be my dad. Getting advice from someone who's played the game and had a career in the game, it's always going to benefit you. Also, around West Ham, there's many coaches that have played the game. There's coaches that have played for West Ham, had long careers in the Premier League, played at high levels, so always getting advice off them. One example for me would be Colton Cole. I think having good people around you is always going to give you an edge, really. Mm-hmm. Emotions and mentality is a massive thing, and it can definitely depend a game for you or a training session. So, yeah, just learning to control that has been quite important for me.
Right, hold on, we're getting... Okay, go on, Manny, take it away, Manny, take it away.
Yeah, I spotted a deer running across.
Nice. So there are two species of deer in this park.
Okay.
And we're going to actually bring in... Okay. Please tell us your name, tell us your role at the park.
So my name is Emily, I'm a comms officer here at the parks, and I work, yeah, quite a lot in Richmond. And we've got two deer in the park. We've got a fallow deer and a red deer, and at the moment it's deer birthing season, so a lot of the mums are giving birth, and the deer that we've just seen has most likely got a baby deer hiding in the grass, so she's on alert. So some of the female deers can be very protective of their young, so it's important that we give them as much space as possible to have their babies.
Nice, Manny, you spotted that.
It was a mixture.
Yeah, it was a mixture.
This is a mixture. I'm not going to take all the credit for it.
Yeah. Team player right there.
Yeah, always put the team first.
We've got some mute swans, a pair of mute swans coming up to the bank right in front of us. Like, the whole gang is here. It looks like there's a trail coming up here, so they might want to use it and we might be putting them off. So what we're going to do is continue on our way, slowly. Speaking of being careful where we're stepping, so there is a species on your list. No, not peacock. Good guess. Have a look. Get the paper out.
It's the parakeet.
Do you reckon that's the parakeet? Yeah, you're spot on. What do you think has happened here?
Jackdaw.
That's an unfair question because it's not on your list. So what's likely to have taken the parakeet here is called a sparrowhawk. So it's a bird of prey, similar in size to like a kestrel or like a little falcon. And that looks like blood, actually. So what the sparrowhawk will have done is caught it in the air, pinned it down, literally pinned it down, and then taken all the hairs off of his chest, and it would have started eating it from the inside until it had its fill, and then it will carry the rest of the carcass away to consume later, and possibly, most probably, to feed its young. So what we've seen there is a crime scene, boys. The day is beautiful. There are clouds above us, but they're all white. There is a bit of a breeze creating some zephyrs rolling along the grass. It's truly a wonderful afternoon to watch some birds and talk football. Look at that. What is that? Jackdaw. What have you noticed about the jackdaws?
To me, it seems like they're not afraid or intimidated.
Why? Because they're not big birds.
Yeah.
They're not powerful. They haven't got especially sharp claws or sharp beaks. What about them makes them so successful and so powerful?
They're a big group. Like, they stick together in that.
Yeah,
so
they stick together. That is fundamental to their success. They keep eyes out for each other, they back each other in fights. And for me, that establishes the corvids, the jackdaws, as more successful, in my opinion, than the parakeets for that reason, because they compete with other species more successfully than the parakeets do. We're slowly making our way back. The boy's eyes, well, Manny's eyes are glued on the prize. He clearly wants to be the man of the match today. He's listening out for the calls. I respect it. To relax, would either of you see yourselves incorporating something like this into your schedule, into your routine?
Yeah, it definitely could be something I'd look at. Like, it's been fun, it's been relaxing, so yeah, why not?
Yeah, especially because where I live, like I mentioned before, there's a lot of wildlife. Mm-hmm. So now that when I take my walks, I'm going to try to look out for the jackdaws and
there you go.
The woodpeckers and
there you know. Go, there you go. These sounds that we're hearing, the sights that we're seeing, boys, it's scientifically proven to reduce anxiety and stress. These sights, these sounds are conducive to good mental well-being. So please, please, please do try and incorporate it as part of your schedule. Right, so I'm going to go with the last question. If you could take one lesson or one thing out of your experience today, what would that be?
Just that calmness, you know? Going to into every situation calm and then just let the rest be what it will be.
Yeah, a similar answer, but for me, finding something new that's also peaceful that I can do on a regular basis, maybe if I start to enjoy this even more as well.
Mm-hmm. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure today. We are just completing our loop around Richmond Park. This has been an amazing day. I'm watching the boys walk on ahead. Peter and Emily are joining them. They are looking at something in the trees, and this might be the decider right here, boys. Peter, what have you spotted here for the boys to get their eyes on?
I saw your favourite bird.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so a green woodpecker came up from the grass where we've been feeding up into this lovely oak tree here.
Uh-huh. I can see it. So it's this tree. If we approach more slowly, I think it will become more visible.
Yeah, it's on the branch, isn't it?
Yeah,
no, I can see it. It's like the second branch up on
no,
the right.
Liam, you've got it. You've got it. So that perfectly brings us to an end, and off it goes. It just flies off there. That brings us to a perfect end with the bird that started my journey into this world. Now we have Liam, who has earned the man of the match. Open Country on Radio 4's very first man of the match. Liam, well done.
No, it was a lucky win, innit? But we'll take him.
There you go.
Open Country was produced in Bristol by Maggie Eyre. Now here's Rory Stewart to tell us what he does and doesn't know.
Knowledge has transformed our understanding of the universe and ourselves. But I'm here to argue that ignorance is just as important.
Every new creative endeavour basically begins in ignorance.
A new series exploring the power of ignorance from art to science to politics.
Just to have in the back of your mind that whatever I believe may in fact be wrong, because that opens me up then to being receptive to other viewpoints.
The Long History of Ignorance from Confucius to QAnon with me, Rory Stewart, on BBC Radio 4. Available now on BBC Sounds.
The Today programme takes to the air in just less than half an hour at 7 o'clock. But first, it's time for Farming Today This Week with Kaz Graham.
Good morning. This week, border controls and spiralling costs for importers, finding the elusive curlew, and belted Galloways join in the battle against bracken.
Come on! We've got 20 up here at the moment. By encouraging them into the bracken, so they trample it down, they lie on it, they squash it. Over time, it should weaken the bracken and stop it growing back.
We start, though, with a trip to the seaside. All week on Farming Today, we've been visiting rural communities all around the UK's coastline and finding out how they're meeting the numerous challenges that they face. For many of those coastal villages and towns, tourism is a vital industry, but it's one which can come at a cost. On the one hand, it bolsters economic growth, but on the other, it can sap the life out of a place with second homes and holiday lets pricing out the locals. Sarah Swadling has been to the Devon village of Beer to find out how they're keeping the community and tourism vibrant.
Beer has pretty much everything that you'd imagine a traditional Devon fishing village would have. There's a steep, pebbly beach that still has small fishing boats pulled up on it. There are deck chairs, beach huts, and winding streets as the village snakes along a tight little valley. But how does a place like this balance the needs of the visitors, the tourist economy, and the people who actually live here? I'm going to meet three guys at the helm of the local community to find out.
Well, I'm high on the cliffs overlooking Beer now at Beerhead Caravan Park, and I'm with Martin Richards, who's chairman of Beer Parish Council, Rick Dormer, who's a farmer and who owns the caravan site here, and Adam Brewer, the chair of Beer Community Land Trust. Martin, what do people come here for? What are they looking for when they come to Beer?
I think it's just because it's an oldie type village, more or less, because it's back to what it was years and years ago, and they've been coming here for years, and that's what they like, and just get away from everything.
Rick, tell me a little bit about, I suppose, how reliant Beer is on visitors coming here.
The caravan park's been here since the 50s. I'm the fourth generation running the ship, I suppose. A lot of people stay here and then they spend the money down in the village. They go to the pubs in the village. They use as a pharmacy in the village. They go on the beach and use all the restaurants along the beach there. So it is, I think, interwoven with the village quite deeply.
So is Beer alive and well in the winter, or is it dead in the winter like some places?
It's not as dead as some places. It's it's reasonably good. Overall, it's not too bad. Mm. Could be worse.
If you come here in the winter, Adam, you know, are there streets where there's not a light on because it's all second homes?
Yeah, and there is that. But I think it's lights on at Christmas, and that's what we need. I think there's about 700 houses in Beer, and we're saying about 40% are second homes, but that also includes rentals, holiday rentals, and that does bring tourism. So it's a double-edged sword. We love tourism. We need tourism to sustain everything that we've got, but we need to balance it on the other side to make sure the community is still strong.
The Community Land Trust concept enabled you to build a couple of developments of affordable homes for local people here in the village, didn't it?
That's right, yeah. So we established in 2013. We built our first project of seven houses, and that was in 2015. Our second project was in 2019-20, and we built a further six houses. Three were rented and three part owned and sold.
Has that helped keep the village younger?
It does help. It keeps the community younger, I believe, although it's open to all ages, and it also helps the school. We've got 100 children in the school.
And Martin, from a parish council point of view, how has the community gone about making sure that there's a beating heart to the village?
Well, every week in the summer, the individual group has a week of their own for fundraising and one thing, others like this week, so we get a week. The football club do one, the sailing club do one, the lifeboat have just done their 200-year one. So there's always something going on in the village to sort of keep people interested. So we've got a mixture of everything to keep the village as it is and going forward.
Martin Richards in Beer, speaking to Sarah Swadling. Now, curlew are an iconic and beautiful bird of moorland and wetland areas. They're large, they're speckled, and they've got a long, downward curved beak, and their haunting call is part of the landscape. But curlew numbers have diminished significantly over the last few decades, with a big drop in breeding populations, placing them firmly on the RSPB's red list, the highest conservation priority. A project in Wales, funded by the Game and Wildlife Conservation Trust, is using drones to locate nests which can then be protected. The drones have thermal and zoom cameras, which means they don't have to be directly above the nest to find it, leaving the birds undisturbed. Two curlew experts have spent the breeding season working with farmers, finding nests and protecting them from predators all before farm work takes place. Anna Hill spoke to Lee Oliver, Interim Director at GWCT Wales.
What the drone does is makes us identify these nests a lot quicker, so releasing man hours. The thing about curlew is they're amazing birds and they're very vocal and very visible when they're flying, but when they nest, they are so secretive and it's so hard to find the nest because they land away from the nest and walk in, often through quite thick cover.
What can farmers do with the information that you're getting? Because it's often on farm land, isn't it, that they're found?
None of the farmers we're working with, and we're working over 40 farmers in the area we're working in Montgomeryshire, they all love their curlew and they want to protect their curlew. As I've never met a farmer that doesn't want wildlife on their farms. They can then say, right, OK, we have a nest in that field, Through the project, we are able to fund them for the protection of the nest, so we can go in and put electric fence around the nest to stop mammal predators going in there to take the eggs or chicks. But then also, when it comes to cutting, we can say, right, we've got a nest in that field. Would you be able to delay that cutting, or would you be able to leave a patch round the actual space where the nest is? And the reaction has been great from farmers.
The Game and Wildlife Conservation Trust is an organisation which supports shooting. So there is a conflict of evidence here. I mean, some studies show that moorland used for grouse shooting is detrimental to curlew because it removes their habitat. But some other research shows that grouse moorland management can remove predators which prey on curlew nests. So how does your curlew work fit alongside being an organisation which supports game shooting?
Yep, you're perfectly correct. We are almost 100 years old in a few years' time now, and we came from shooting, and shooting is still, and game shooting is still a large part of our work, but increasingly we are working on lots more conservation projects. This work works hand in hand with conservation and shooting. The added benefits of shooting is to increase conservation. We work on these sort of the three-legged stool, so the provision of food for species, the provision of habitat, and the protection from predators. So within this project that we're doing now, we are doing a lot of predation management, so controlling corvids, carrion crow and foxes, has shown a knock-on effect then to the increase of chicks that have been seen to fledge this year. So, you know, some of the success stories of curlew are from the Yorkshire moors, where there's lots of curlew breeding, and that's because of game management and grouse moors, and the fact that the predation management is done very well, which enables a room for curlew chicks and eggs to survive.
I suppose some people might say, well, you don't have to do that. Could you not just improve the habitat, leave everything alone, don't kill things, and just help the curlew instead?
Yeah, and I think some projects have done that. We've shown that, you know, that predation management does work, that we've shown with our Allerton project, our demonstration farm, predation management happened. We took a 10-year gap of predation not happening, and species decline. The graph falls for all species, not just curlew, but, you know, songbirds and everything. And then we started predation management again. So no one wants to get rid of every crow. No one wants to get rid of every fox. But we have to have that balance of predators and vulnerable species like the curlew that nest on the ground and are vulnerable to all predators.
And what do you hope your research to bring about? Are you expecting then that your work will help save more chicks and therefore that the populations will increase?
If you think of entering a field and of a foot-high silage and wanting to locate chicks to see if they're safe for the cutting that's going to happen next week, that could take hours, if not the whole day, to try and find them just of observation. Whereas the drone, we proved within, I think it was 5 minutes, 30 seconds, we located all four chicks, right, they're safe, they're there in the corner of the field, we can move on to the next field. And that just tenfold increases the conservation efforts that we can put on the ground and help curlew and help that survival rate.
Lee Oliver from the Game and Wildlife Conservation Trust in Wales. Now, bracken, as you probably know, is a large and very prolific fern, and it can be a big problem for farmers, particularly in the uplands. It eats into grazing land, it harbours ticks, and it's difficult to control, especially since last autumn when Asulox, the only herbicide used to kill it, became permanently withdrawn from the UK and Europe. The Innovative Farmers Network has just started trialling non-chemical approaches to bracken control, one of which involves using cattle to trample it. Catherine Pinfold, who farms in the northeastern Lake District, is taking part in their pilot. She has a herd of around 150 belted Galloway cattle, and she took me up the fells to show me what they're up to.
This is Burnbank Fell, and there's a fabulous view over Lowe's Water and Crummock Water in the distance.
It's really beautiful. And also in the distance, we can see a great swathe of bracken on the hillside. And we can see some belted Galloways, can't we?
Belties in the bracken.
Let's go find them.
Come on. Come on.
How many of these belted Galloways do you have up here?
We've got 20 up here at the moment.
And this bracken
It almost covers them, doesn't it? It's huge. Absolutely huge.
We did some measuring last week and it averages between a metre and a metre and a half.
What are the problems that bracken like this poses for you as a farmer?
It takes over. It's a monoculture. Although other vegetation does grow in between it, it's very, very dominant and reduces the productivity of the farm, because if there was less bracken and more grass, we could graze more animals up here.
Oh, yeah, we've got a friend here. We've got a little visitor who's just emerging from the bracken. Hello there. Classic belted Galloway. Beautiful black back and front with that fantastic white stripe right round his middle. It makes him look a bit like a humbug.
Yes, indeed. Oreo cows, they're sometimes called.
Right, these fellas are just beginning to tuck into the feed you've brought up here while they are dining. Catherine, tell me, what is the kind of theory behind this project that you're involved in, this trial for innovative farmers?
It's called the Bracken Lab. The idea is to add a bit of science to the effect on bracken of trampling with livestock by encouraging them into the bracken so they trample it down, they lie on it, they squash it. Over time, it should weaken the bracken and stop it growing back. We're working as a group of 8 farmers across the north of England. Different farmers are using slightly different methods, but the idea is that we have a test area that we encourage the livestock into and a control area where they don't go. Each year we will take a photograph of each area, measure the bracken, its density, its height, take soil samples and see how the areas evolve over time and what difference there is between the control area and the test area.
Well, these trials are also looking at the impact that bracken management with cattle like these here, Belties, will have on the biodiversity of each site involved. And just making his way through the Belted Galloways is Martin Wayne from the Butterfly Conservation Trust. He's their lead for the north of England. Martin, we're just looking out at this bracken. Isn't bracken just really a bit of a monoculture? It's not good habitat for anything apart from ticks and, this Belted Galloway that's approaching us at the moment.
Through the bracken.
Is it any good for anything?
Well, some of our rarest butterflies in the country need bracken habitat to thrive and survive. We have a butterfly in the northwest called the high brown fritillary. It needs bracken litter with violets growing through it, and the females lay their eggs on that bracken litter. The caterpillars hatch out. Bracken litter is a really good fleecy material, so it's a really warm environment for those caterpillars to live in. They eat the violets and then they pupate and turn into the high browns. We're looking here, though, looking at the bracken that we've got here. I can't see any common dog violet growing in here. We've got
some of that out of the way.
We've got wood sorrel growing. We've got creeping buttercup. All these are sort of negative indicators for this habitat quality that I'm specifically looking for. But it's really nice to be working with farmers and inviting me out here to see if there is any high quality bracken habitat before or during while you're doing your trials. And working with farmers is one of the things that we're really keen to do.
And I guess what you can do is you can come back here in another year, another 2 years, and see what the situation is, see how it looks, can't you?
Yes, that's what it's all about, monitoring things over time so we can see the change, so we can see any benefits for wildlife, and we can help the farmers to make sure that all the things that they're doing benefit the wildlife after the 5 years.
The cattle are mostly interested in the bag of cake you brought up with you. They're all gathered around the quad doing that, but what do they make of it? Do you think they quite like it, or are they really not fussed about anything as long as they've got something to eat?
When we put them up on the fell initially, some of them try and get back and they hang around the wall at the bottom saying, "Let me back in, I don't like it." But then they get the hang of it and they're fine. And they do really well up here, actually.
Catherine Pinfold and her herd of Belted Galloways just above Loweswater in Cumbria. Businesses that import meat, both fresh and processed, could have to pay up to 6 times more than they were expecting to get each lorry through border controls. That's according to the British Meat Processors Association. Since April, businesses that import through Dover and the Eurotunnel through Folkestone have been paying what's called a common user charge. The price importers pay depends on the number of different products in each consignment. Peter Hardwick is the trade policy advisor for the British Meat Processors Association, and he explained why the price per truck could be much higher than businesses were expecting.
It's quite possible that you've got a grouped truck with several consignments on it, each with 5 different product codes on it. So the charge is per product code. So you could have a lot more than £145 worth of charges on a truck. You may, of course, in some cases have a lot less. I accept that.
The figures that you're quoting are that the maximum of £145 per truck that people were anticipating could end up being
more like 870, which with my maths makes it six times more than they would have been expecting to pay. Is that right?
Well, of course, that is theoretically possible. I'm not suggesting that that's true in every case, but there will be truckloads where it's a lot more than £145. I mean, I've used...
You heard from businesses who've had this extra expenditure that they weren't expecting?
What I have heard from is that the bills are much higher, I think, than people initially anticipated. No one is saying they weren't expecting these charges. They knew they were coming through, but they've come through at a level which, of course, is perhaps caught some out.
And what impact, though, will these increased prices have?
Ultimately, they have to be picked up somewhere in the supply chain, so they add to the cost of food. The idea of this charge was to cover the structural cost of building the Sevington border control post, something which, of course, we believe is a waste of money. It could have easily been done at the existing facilities in Dover and at Eurotunnel, instead of which they built a facility which is only handling 2% or less of all those goods coming in anyway. It's time there was a proper review of this charge, ideally to get rid of it altogether, but perhaps more importantly, to look at the need to go through all these processes in the first place. And we think there's an opportunity with a new government to have a proper discussion with the European Union about some sort of alignment agreement, because we already effectively have the same rules as the EU, that we do this in a more formal way and get rid of the need for all these checks and paperwork.
I mean, DEFRA, I imagine, would argue that Sevington is necessary and that all of these checks are critical for protecting biosecurity, preventing animal disease from entering the UK.
The reality is this, when the whole model was first considered, the premise for imports was checks in the region of between 15 and 30%, the sort of checks that would take place on goods coming in from non-EU countries into the EU. So the border target operating model said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to check at a much lower level. So if we say this is essential, then we ought to be checking at a level which reflects the management of the risk. At 2%, random checks, I don't believe we're significantly improving biosecurity. And the reality is, of course, we're importing from the European Union in this particular case, from which goods moved freely prior to Brexit. So I'm not convinced that that argument holds water. We have largely aligned rules with the EU anyway. And secondly, the level of checks isn't at a level which I think guarantees biosecurity.
DEFRA has said that it's committed to seeking a veterinary agreement with the EU to prevent unnecessary border checks. How much difference would that make?
Well, it would make a huge difference if it was an agreement similar to the one, let's say, that Switzerland have with the European Union, where effectively they agree they're in a common veterinary area, and that whilst they are not formally and legally aligned, they are effectively aligned, and as a consequence of which there is no need for export health certificates or checks of this nature. So movements between Switzerland and the European Union don't require those sorts of checks. They are in effectively the common veterinary area, which is the best way of describing it. If we could have that, then we'd get rid of all these checks altogether and save an awful lot of money, because it's costing hundreds of millions of pounds, make no mistake.
That's Peter Hardwick from the British Meat Processors Association. We contacted DEFRA for a response to this, and as expected, they told us risk-based checks on certain imports are essential to protect our national biosecurity and prevent an outbreak of disease that would severely damage our food supply, the environment and future trade. The Common User Charge supports these vital checks by paying the operating costs of the border control post at Sevington. Now, finally, let us take a trip back to 1964. Manfred Mann were at number one in the charts with a Doo Wah Diddy Diddy. There was a new Agriculture and Horticulture Act, and the BBC launched a new weekend farming programme. 60 years later, it is still going strong. The first ever On Your Farm was an early morning outside broadcast from a family farm in Rutland as the day's harvesting got underway in the surrounding fields. To mark the programme's diamond anniversary, Vernon Harwood has visited that same farm to check on today's harvest and to discover what's changed over the past six decades.
We're in Rutland, England's smallest county near the village of Barrowden, and this land is farmed by Richard and Charles Tyler. Harvest well underway, as it was back in 1964.
Yes, just about finished our winter barley and oilseed rape. and then we'll have a little bit of a lull before moving into winter wheats.
Richard, thank you for inviting us back after all this time. Your brother Charles is here as well. This is West Farm, close to the heart of the village of Barrowden. And this is the location of the first programme, which went out at 7.15 on Saturday, the 29th of August, 1964. Richard's wife, Joan, has joined us. This farm is quite historic for all sorts of reasons.
It is indeed. Not only was it the farm where the programme was, but it's also where Thomas Cook, the travel pioneer, lived for some part of his life.
Those foreign holidays all started here, the genesis of them at least.
It is indeed.
Now, we ought to point out that Charles and Richard were only little boys when that programme went out.
Yes, I was only 10 years old when the programme went out. They came here to talk to my uncle, Rowley Tyler, and my father, Dennis Tyler. Father looked after most of the livestock side of the farm, and my uncle did all the arable side.
Back in those days, On Your Farm was broadcast live, and sadly a recording hasn't survived. But in the autobiography of the producer of the programme, then and for many years later, Anthony Parkin, there's a lovely description of that Saturday morning. He talks about the OB vehicle parked in the attractive stable yard, which is more or less where we're standing now.
Yes.
He talks about the cables with microphones attached in different locations, and then very intricately a Land Rover fitted with a transmitter so that they could broadcast from the vehicle whilst driving or when it was stationary. It sounds quite an operation, doesn't it?
It does. Luckily today you've just got a little microphone.
Yes,
with you.
I'm sorry about the disappointment. Just me and a microphone, I'm afraid. Things were very different though, weren't they, back in 64 here?
Yeah, completely different. The farmyard here has been developed. I think there's five houses now in the farmyard, plus the farmhouse. Back in 64, we had sheep and cattle and cropping, similar today, although we've dropped the cattle in 1996 due to the BSE crisis.
In some ways, we're almost turning the clock back a little bit in that we're, like everybody else, trying a bit of this regenerative farming and introducing cover crops and companion cropping for certain other things we're growing.
Well, I was interested to see that where you had trouble planting beans earlier on this year, you've actually turned that over to a wildflower mix.
Well, we use the SFI to get a flower mix in there for the summer flowering.
That's a subsidy, effectively.
Effectively a subsidy because it was too wet to get the beans in there. So we did take advantage of that this year, but it's not a thing I like doing personally. My gut feeling is we should be producing food.
I'm really looking forward to hearing that. And you can hear more from that special anniversary On Your Farm tomorrow morning at 6.35 and also in a special extended edition on Tuesday at 3.30pm. That's it from us for today, though. I'm Kath Graham. The producer is Beatrice Fenton. Farming Today is a BBC Audio Bristol production for BBC Radio 4. Have a good bank holiday weekend.
And of course, there's more from the Farming Today Monday to Friday mornings at 5:45. Now with an update on the weather, here's Elizabeth Rizzini.
Thanks, Alan. Well, Storm Lillian yesterday brought gusts of wind of up to 60 to 70 miles an hour for some. It has been a wet and a windy night, but the storm's now cleared. But it's still wet in the south for many of us for much of the morning. Some showers too moving into northwest Scotland still, but it's wettest at the moment across southeast Wales, for southern England, the Midlands, East Anglia, parts of Yorkshire as well, seeing some outbreaks of rain through this morning, plenty of cloud around. Some of that rain likely to turn heavy at times, and there is a localised Met Office weather warning valid until 1 o'clock this afternoon for parts of South East England and East Anglia that have seen a very dry August, of course. So welcome rain for some of the gardens, but some of that rain could lead to some localised flooding, quite a lot of it for some places. The rain will clear away as we head towards lunchtime and into the mid-afternoon. Most of that will have moved off into the North Sea. Sunny spells behind the front with some heavy thundery showers too possible, especially for central and eastern areas of England. Away from that rain towards the south, then elsewhere, it's a day of sunny spells and some showers. Quite a bright start to the day, but the showers will get going. They'll be most frequent, I think, for northwest Scotland, but some sunny spells in between. Northern Ireland, sunny spells and some showers. It's still windy in the far north and west, but lighter winds developing elsewhere. A brisk southwesterly to westerly wind blowing. It's still quite blustery for the time of year, and it will be cooler than it would normally be. normally be to 16 to 19 Celsius, England and Wales. Perhaps locally 20 or 21 Celsius, though, for the best of the sunshine. That's probably most likely across the Midlands. And 14 to 17 degrees for Scotland and Northern Ireland. Now, it leads on to a cool feeling night tonight for the time of year. The showers will fade away. There'll be clear spells developing, clouds thickening in the west by the time we get to tomorrow morning. Lows for most of 7 to 10 degrees. Tomorrow, the heaviest of the rain will be across northwest England and southwest Scotland, drier elsewhere.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Now, just before we join the Today programme, there's just time for a quick tune-up.
On BBC Radio 4.
Maybe the goal of a rehearsal is not to dictate exactly the way everything needs to go, but to test the limits of what's possible.
An insider's view of classical music's best-loved works.
It's like colouring in a black and white outline of a painting.
Inside music with the people who perform it.
When you're really close, you should fly.
How to play, starting with Mozart's Requiem.
There's something quite perfect about his music that I'm not sure I can really put into words.
This Monday morning at 9:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday the 24th of August. This is Today with Lise Doucette and Simon Jack.
The headlines this morning. Police in Germany are hunting for an attacker who stabbed three people to death at a festival and wounded eight others. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has appeared at a rally to endorse Donald Trump after he scrapped his own independent bid to be the next US president. And the sacked BBC presenter, Germaine Ginas, has said he feels ashamed about sending inappropriate messages to female colleagues.
Also in today's programme, as the government summons energy providers to a meeting next week, what should be done about this winter's higher bills? How Kamala Harris has been shunning journalists and giving her time to social influencers, and Bristol's alive with the sound of the BBC proms. We'll speak to the man in charge of making it happen.
I'm Jonathan Ledyard at the first test at Old Trafford, where England's latest centurion, Jamie Smith, has the hosts firmly on the front foot against Sri Lanka.
Thanks, Jonathan. The BBC News this morning is read by Alan Smith.
German police are searching for an attacker who fatally stabbed three people in the western city of Solingen. Five others were seriously wounded. Witnesses have reported that a man stabbed passers-by at random during events marking the anniversary of the city's founding. The motive for the attack still is not clear. Damien McGuinness reports from Berlin.
Solingen is in a state of shock this morning after three people were killed in a stabbing at a local festival last night. The attacker, who is still on the run, appears to have been acting alone. Police have blocked off roads and have asked eyewitnesses to contact them directly with any information or pictures via a special hotline. It's still not clear what was behind the attack, and politicians have called on people to avoid any speculation, saying there's so far no evidence about who the perpetrator was. According to one German media report, the attacker stabbed people indiscriminately with a knife. The region's leader, Hendrik Wüst, called the stabbing a brutal and senseless act of violence.
Robert F. Kennedy has appeared on stage with Donald Trump after abandoning his own independent bid for the White House and throwing his support behind the former president. Mr. Kennedy, a member of America's most storied political family, said he no longer had a realistic path to victory, with polls suggesting his support had dwindled to less than 5%. Here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
Both Robert F. Kennedy's uncle, John, and his father, Robert, were assassinated during a period of political turbulence that rocked this country in the 1960s. And last month, Donald Trump himself was also the subject of an attempt on his life. On stage in Arizona, he announced the formation of an independent commission that would be tasked with releasing all the remaining documents relating to the death of John F. Kennedy back in 1963. Mr. Trump praised his newest supporter, saying his campaign had inspired people.
He knows firsthand the risks incurred by leaders who stand up to the corrupt political establishment. But I will tell you, we are both in this to do what's right for the country.
Robert Kennedy Jr. entered the presidential race as a Democrat before switching to become an independent, and his endorsement of Donald Trump injects a new dose of uncertainty into what has become a tight race for the White House.
The presenter and football pundit Jermaine Genus has said he feels deeply ashamed after he was sacked by the BBC for sending inappropriate messages to female colleagues. In an interview with the Sun newspaper, the former footballer apologises to the women for making them feel uncomfortable and to his wife. Will Vernon has more details.
In his interview, Jermaine Genus accepts he sent inappropriate text messages to two female colleagues on The One Show and says he recognises his behaviour fell below the standards of the BBC. He says he's sorry for what he calls mistakes and asks his family for forgiveness.
This is completely on me. I am 100% in the wrong and I accept full responsibility for that. And it's something that obviously I need to address and look at myself.
Jermaine Genus also claims he is not a sex pest and says the texts were between consenting adults. The Sun says he is now considering suing the BBC for their handling of the scandal. On Thursday, the corporation announced it had sacked the former footballer from The One Show and Match of the Day. The BBC has been keen to show it can act quickly when such accusations arise after being criticised for its response to allegations of inappropriate behaviour on Strictly Come Dancing.
The body set up to provide compensation to victims of the infected blood scandal has been given the power to start making payments. 30,000 people were infected with HIV and hepatitis C after treatment with contaminated blood products. 3,000 of them died. But as our health editor Hugh Pym reports, some groups are unhappy with the amounts on offer.
After a campaign lasting decades, a public inquiry concluded in May that doctors, governments and the NHS had repeatedly failed victims. Now the Infected Blood Compensation Authority has been formally set up. The first payments to those infected will start at the end of the year. The Hepatitis C Trust said people had waited too long, though it was welcome that the new body had been established at long last. But the Trust went on to say there were still concerns at the disparities in the proposed compensation for people with hepatitis viruses and HIV. A spokesperson said many given hepatitis C in infected blood did not find out till many years afterwards and were having to live with the long-term consequences such as cirrhosis and liver cancer. The Trust added that it was hard to understand why they should receive lower compensation, and without a fair scheme, many would face further delays to justice. A government spokesperson said advice on compensation payments had come from an expert advisory group.
Prosecutors in Sicily are expected to outline the initial findings of their investigation into the sinking of the superyacht Baesian this morning. Seven people died when the vessel went down during a storm off the coast of the island on Monday. Those killed include the British tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch and his daughter Hannah. 15 people were rescued. Sir Keir Starmer has promised that the UK will back the people of Ukraine today and always as the country celebrates 33 years since it declared independence from the Soviet Union. Separately, the Defence Secretary, John Healey, has suggested that Ukraine's incursion into Russian territory has sown doubt in Moscow about President Putin's leadership. Our political correspondent Helen Catt reports.
The UK has been a staunch backer of Ukraine since the Russian invasion, and Labour has been keen to make clear that a change of government does not mean a change in approach. Sir Keir said he had a crystal clear message to all Ukrainians, whether they were on the front line or here in what he described as their second home in the UK. That message, he said, was that the UK was with them today and always. Writing in The Telegraph, the Defence Secretary John Healey claimed that Ukraine's operation in the Kursk region had sown doubt inside Russia and exposed what he called Putin's Kremlin cabal to the consequences of their aggression.
Anyone found guilty of stealing a cat or dog in England and Northern Ireland could now face up to 5 years in prison under a new law that's come into force today. Previously, the theft of a household animal was treated in the same way as the stealing of an object. Alex Findlow from the charity Dogs Trust says the change reflects the severity of the crime.
A lot of dog owners will consider
their dog as part of the family, as another family member. So it's great that there is this new law now that will recognise just how distressing and how emotional it would be for somebody to lose a family member, even if they're a dog, and for it to be treated in the same vein.
Somerset House in central London reopens to the public today for the first time since it was damaged by a fire last weekend. More than 100 firefighters responded to the blaze in the west wing of the building. The London Fire Brigade is continuing to investigate the cause. Here's our culture reporter, Noor Nanji.
Members of the public will be allowed back into Somerset House today, where two events are taking place, an exhibition called The Law of Loverboy and an evening event, an open-air ball in its famous courtyard. Artists and small businesses have been able to return to the historic site since Tuesday. The Courtauld Gallery, which houses priceless artwork, including by Van Gogh, reopened the day after the blaze. The extent of the damage and the cause of the fire aren't yet known, but there were no casualties and there were no works of art in the part of the building where the fire broke out.
The Paralympic flame will be lit at Stoke Mandeville in Buckinghamshire today. It'll then begin its journey to Paris, where the Games are due to get underway on Wednesday. Stoke Mandeville hosted the first competition for wheelchair athletes in 1948, an event which developed into the Paralympic Games. The flame will be lit by the GB rower Helen Rainsford and the wheelchair curler Gregor Ewan.
Alan Smith, thank you. It's now just coming up to 7:10, and we're going to start in Germany in that shattered music festival. Three people were killed and eight were injured late last night in a knife attack in the western city of Solingen. That's what German police are saying, and a police spokesperson has given a few details on the attacker.
Also, eine Gefahr, wir gehen von einem Einzeltäter aus.
We assume a single offender. He's on the run. He killed three people at the city festival and seriously injured at least four. So we can't say that he's not dangerous.
Well, let's go join our correspondent in Germany, Damien McGuinness. Damien, first of all, tell us what's known about exactly what happened.
Well, according to media reports and some eyewitnesses, the attacker appeared to stab various people seemingly at random. Police say it seems the attacker was aiming for the neck. In the chaos, the attacker appears to have managed to have escaped and is still on the run, which is why much of the city now is being cordoned off. Armed police are searching the area. And that's really the big question now, Lise, like, to track down who this person was and to make sure nothing further happens. Police are not warning of imminent danger, but of course the priority is to find the perpetrator. There's been an update on the injured as well since that police spokesman gave his comment just now, and now out of the eight who were injured, five are now seriously injured and three have died of their wounds. So this is a serious incident and it's really left the whole city in shock.
And will it have wider repercussions? It's not the first time there's been an attack like this. This one's, of course, taken place in a smaller community in the west of the country.
Yeah, that's right, Lise. I mean, what we've seen over the past few years is a number of incidents involving knives. Now, this has already sparked a debate here, a national debate among politicians about how to clamp down on knife violence. In June, a 29-year-old police officer died of his wounds after defending demonstrators who were attacked by someone carrying a knife. And then in 2021, there was an incident on a train where a number of people were seriously injured after someone attacked at random with a knife. And so this has led to a large debate about changing policy, decreasing the size of knives allowed to be owned in public. But there is a feeling that all of those measures about how big a knife can be are essentially cosmetic, because these knives are instruments that any kitchen can have. So this is a difficult debate, and it's one that a lot of people would say you can't solve simply by changing policy. This sort of violence is relatively rare in Germany compared to some other countries, but because we've seen over the last few years a couple of quite high-profile incidents, this has rattled people. And as I say, it's changed the debate and really got people talking about how to clamp down on knife violence in particular.
Yeah, big question for Germany, not just Germany. Damien McGuinness, thank you.
12 minutes past seven. Let's have a look at the morning papers, and the front pages remain preoccupied about that 10% increase in the energy price cap that was announced yesterday. The Guardian reports Keir Starmer is facing pressure from Labour backbenchers to extend financial support to vulnerable people this winter. It says MPs are warning that thousands could die because of a combination of the household support fund ending in September and winter fuel payments being scrapped for many pensioners.
The Labour MP Rachel Maskell, who chairs a group that looks into issues affecting older people, tells The Times she is deeply concerned about restricting the winter fuel allowance. She compares the cut to the tens of billions of pounds of profits made by oil and gas companies. An unnamed Labour MP says, "My inbox has been on fire." An anonymous minister tells the paper, "My worry is things are only going to get worse with the further cuts, difficult decisions that will have to be made in the budget due to the mess that was bequeathed to us."
And the Mail's editorial says many pensioners this winter will be forced to choose between heating and eating. The Express says the sooner Rachel Reeves reverses her decision, the less painful it will be. The Mirror says the new government risks severe political damage if it continues with the plans. We'll be speaking to Age UK about this issue a bit later in the programme.
And beyond British shores, the Defence Secretary John Healey has told The Telegraph that Ukraine's incursion into the Kursk region of Russia has, in his words, sown doubts into the minds of Russians about President Putin's leadership. In an article for the paper, Mr. Healey says the offensive has exposed Putin's Kremlin cabal to the consequences of their aggression.
The Eye reports that a new problem is facing the £57 billion HS2 project. A large gap between the train's doors and station platforms mean the trains are unsafe to use at 11 existing stations on the route. The paper suggests the taxpayer is facing an almost £200 million bill to refit the carriages. The Office of Rail and Road has said it has no current concerns about HS2 rolling stock.
And that's our look at the papers. It's coming up to 7:15, and let's cross the ocean to the race for the White House is picking up speed after the Democrats formally confirmed their candidate, Kamala Harris. And there's been another development. One of the contenders, the independent candidate, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has suspended his campaign and endorsed Donald J. Trump, who brought him on stage at a rally in Arizona.
Tonight, I'm very pleased to welcome a man who has been an incredible champion for so many of these values that we all share, and we've shared them for a long time. I don't think too many of you people have heard of him. He's very low-key. He's a very low-key person, but he's highly respected. He is a great person. I've known him for so long. For the past 16 months, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Well, certainly a lot of Simon. There's been a huge positive reaction, at least on that stage in Arizona. Let's bring in Brian Klass, the Associate Professor of Global Politics at UCL. He writes for The Atlantic. Brian, is there really shared values in these two among these two politicians?
They're sort of strange bedfellows, but there is one part of Kennedy's campaign that appeals to voters who are part of Trump's base, and that's that Kennedy's main signature issue is he opposes vaccines. He's been an anti-vaxxer for quite some time. And so that may have appealed to some of the people in Trump's base who were turned off by Trump's embrace of vaccines during his time in the White House. It's an extremely unusual campaign. I mean, for those who have not been following this closely, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. previously disclosed during his campaign that literally a worm ate part of his brain, and also talked about how he had dropped a dead bear carcass in Central Park in New York previously. I mean, the roller coaster ride of this campaign is like nothing I have ever seen before.
And he carries the great Kennedy name, that famed political dynasty in America. Now, you use this word base. Does Robert F. Kennedy Jr. have a base himself? And will it now make a difference to the course of this campaign?
No, he doesn't have a base. He was the neither nor candidate. He was the person who people turned to when they didn't want to vote for Trump or Biden. And this is part of the reason why it's really unclear how this will shake up the race, because the people who would have voted for Biden or would have voted for Democrats normally but didn't want to vote for Biden have already now come home to Kamala Harris's campaign. In other words, because she has energized the base of the Democrats, the people who are left in RFK Jr.'s camp before he dropped out were largely a smaller group of people who don't like Democrats or Republicans generally. And so, you know, he was polling between 2-5% when he's now suspended his campaign, which is very different from where he was at when Biden was in the race, which as some polls suggested was as high as 15%.
As you know, a lot of interest in this rally because also because it came after the end of the Democratic convention and President and former President Trump admitting he's looking for a nickname that will land for Kamala Harris. He's been trying out a few, but it seems he's settled on, tell us, Comrade Kamala.
Yeah, so he's sort of been workshopping a series of insults and attacks, but he hasn't been very focused. And I think this may have come too little too late because she has had, and I think that most political commentators on the right would agree with this. She's had one of the best 30 days of any American politician in modern political history. It's been a near flawless rollout of her candidacy. And she defined herself to the American people at the convention in a really high profile way. So now trying to label her as this sort of left-wing communist, which just doesn't ring true when she's part of an administration that is quite clearly extraordinarily capitalist. I don't know if it's going to work the same way that Trump's masterful sort of branding worked against, for example, Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden.
Well, it's something, it's a race to watch. Brian Klass, thank you for joining us.
I love the idea of workshopping insults. The kind of thing that Malcolm Tucker might have done back in the thick of it. Let us talk, though, as we went through the paper review, a lot of them were preoccupied by the government's decision to means test winter fuel payments. And that has been thrown into sharp relief by yesterday's news that average energy bills are going up by 10%. This is average use for an average household from October. That's a rise of £149 for a household with average use of gas and electricity, and that comes as 10 million pensioner households will lose up to £300 a year in winter fuel payments. We can talk to Georgia Roberts, our political correspondent, and Georgia, disquiet inside Labour as well.
That's right, yeah. I mean, bills won't be as high as we've seen in recent winters, but that doesn't make it any easier for families up and down the country, and certainly the politics won't get any easier for Labour, as you say. This has been thrown into sharp relief by Rachel Reeves' decision to scrap the winter fuel allowance for millions of pensioners, and I think reflective of the fact that the government know they're under some pressure here is this decision to call a meeting next week with the top energy companies to discuss what they are calling proactive and essential commitments on how they can further support people, particularly when it comes to energy debt. But you mentioned those Labour voices. We heard on this programme yesterday from Rachel Maskell, the Labour MP for York, calling for Rachel Reeves to rethink that policy. We've also had some more Labour voices this morning, Clive Betts, the MP, and also a Labour peer coming out saying this is a terrible decision. So we know that the Conservatives are seeking to keep up the pressure on this. They're calling for a debate in Parliament when MPs get back to the Commons in September on winter fuel payments. But those voices within Labour are going to be particularly difficult. It's hard to gauge the scale of the discomfort with this policy at the moment because, of course, MPs are not in the Commons. But I think certainly when we get back to from recess, it feels like Rachel Reeves will come under pressure, not necessarily for a full-on U-turn, although there's indications some would be happy with this within Labour, but at least, for example, to extend some financial support programmes for people that are due to expire, like the Household Support Fund, for example.
OK, Georgia, thank you very much indeed. As we say, we're going to be talking to the Chief Executive of Age UK and the founder of Ecotricity and a Labour donor, Dale Vince, just at 10 past 8. Georgia Roberts, thank you.
Israeli media reported this week that the head of the Israeli security agency, Shin Bet, has warned the prime minister that what he called Jewish terrorism in the West Bank was endangering Israel's existence. Since the start of the Gaza war, there's been a dramatic increase in settler violence and settlement growth in the occupied West Bank. Palestinians are now protesting against new Israeli takeovers of their privately owned land on a UNESCO World Heritage site near Bethlehem. Extremists in Israel's government boast that these changes will prevent an independent Palestinian state from ever being created. Our Middle East correspondent, Yolan Nell, reports.
I'm a farmer by default, you know. Everybody is a farmer. Engineer or a mayor, he's a farmer.
In this picturesque Palestinian village, life carries on as it has for centuries, with its natural spring used to irrigate the ancient terraces. It's part of a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Batiri is famous with the eggplants and call it Batiri. When you go to the market, they are shouting, saying, Batiri, Batiri, for sale.
Ghassan Olian is proud of his land. But now part is being taken for a brand new Israeli settlement. Under international law, all settlements are considered illegal.
They are not caring about the international law or the local law and even the God's law. They are stealing our land to build their dreams on our catastrophe.
Nearby, activists join a protest by the Kassia family. Last month, Israeli soldiers forced them off their land and settlers moved in. Alice Kassia says far-right minister Bezalel Smotrich, who now has broad control over policy here, is tightening Israel's hold on the West Bank.
They took advantage of the war because all eyes on Gaza. Smotrich established this before a few days ago about the new settlement, but we can see in the map that this area, it's not included. It's really hard because you're fighting a system.
Secretly recorded by an Israeli anti-occupation group, Bezalel Smotrich recently laid out his bureaucratic steps towards de facto annexation of the West Bank. Settlement construction has already been turbocharged. For Israel's religious nationalists, the Bible is the Jewish people's deed to this land. And Ohad Tal, an MP from Mr. Smotrich's party, tells us they're fighting against the creation of a Palestinian state, part of the long-time international formula for peace here.
The failed policy of giving parts of our land to the Palestinians only brought terror and bloodshed to the Palestinians and to Israelis. We've stopped doing that.
I'm sorry, don't speak to
you. What are you doing here?
We're at the BBC, a journalist.
What IDs?
While recording by a settler outpost in the World Heritage Site, our BBC team is stopped by two armed men. One is masked and in a military uniform. He speaks English with a British accent.
Are you living here or are you in the army?
No comment.
Are you British?
Yes.
Okay.
Hold on, I'll call my superiors, see what we're doing with you.
Can I have my ID back?
In a minute.
They ordered us to leave. UNESCO says it's concerned by the settlers' plans around Battir. But for Palestinians, this is not just about preserving an historic site. It's about keeping hope for the future.
Yolande Donnell reporting from Bethlehem.
It is 25 minutes past seven. Sacked BBC pundit Jermaine Genis has apologised for sending inappropriate messages to two colleagues on The One Show. Having initially said he was unhappy at his sacking and taking legal advice, he's now said he's ashamed and deeply sorry. Here's Jermaine Genis speaking exclusively to The Sun newspaper in an interview released last night.
Firstly, to say sorry to my wife, to my family, to the women involved as well, and what I've put them through. But also this kind of rumours that just kind of start, and I think it's really important that I kind of put my point across that there is nothing illegal that has happened here. This is consenting adults that messaged each other. Now, this is completely on me. I am 100% in the wrong and I accept full responsibility for that.
Well, Charlotte Gallagher is our culture correspondent, is on the line. And Charlotte, there's been a change of tactics here. First of all, he said he was fuming and angry about it. A full kind of mea culpa today.
Totally, Simon. This is a very different Jermaine Genis to what we saw in an interview with TalkSport on Thursday, and he was saying he wasn't happy, there are two sides to the story, he was talking to his lawyers. This interview with The Sun, he's very apologetic, he's very contrite, saying it's 100% his fault, he's ashamed, he's let everyone down. He calls those messages a huge error of judgment. But in that interview, he really is keen to stress, he says, that they were between consenting adults. So he says he was messaging two female colleagues on The One Show. He says there's nothing illegal in those messages, and he says he's not a sex pest. He talks about the effect it's had on his career and also his family. He was sacked, he says, while he was on holiday with his family via Zoom on Monday. The BBC called him and said, look, you're fired.
Yeah, and he was actually, some of these texts apparently were read to him by a panel of BBC executives.
Yes, and obviously he said that was incredibly embarrassing, having those messages read out to him on a Zoom call. I think the BBC are going to feel pretty vindicated by this, because he's admitted sending these messages after initially sort of being very, very defensive about it. And in the past, the BBC has been really criticised, for example, with Hugh Edwards, about when complaints have been made about their stars. They really, some people have said, have dragged their heels. They've not acted quickly enough. We all remember that Hugh Edwards, he was paid £200,000 in that period after he was arrested before he resigned. In this case with Jermaine Genus, he's been sacked within weeks of those allegations being made. There was a line in the Sun interview where he said he was consulting with lawyers and he was considering suing the BBC over the way they had handled the crisis. Mm. But obviously, Simon, this is a man who's trying to cling on to his career and his reputation.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? And one wonders whether by doing this kind of confession, that allows a door to open to him in the future. Is there a way back for him?
I don't think there's a way back for him at the BBC. I would be really, really surprised about that. You know, he had really tried to position himself as the man that was going to take over from Gary Lineker on Match of the Day as the main presenter. That is so, so unlikely to happen now. I can't really see him working for the BBC again in the future. TalkSport have said they've got no plans to work with him in the immediate future. He was doing some motor racing work, some presenting work. They say they haven't made a decision yet. TNT, another sports broadcaster who he works for, they've not made a decision yet. And we have seen people in the past, figures from the sporting world, do things, say things, and then they do make a comeback.
OK. All right. Thanks very much indeed there. Charlotte Gallagher, our culture correspondent.
Time now for Jonathan Ledyard. He's got not just the sports news, but weather as well from Old Trafford Cricket Ground.
Good morning. I thought you were going to say mowers as well, because you've got plenty of them too. It's cool, it's grey, and above all, it's dry here in Manchester for the ground staff. We've been on site since just after six, as you can hear. They've been mowing the lush green outfield since around 6:30, preparing a stage where the gloves came off in style yesterday for England's new wicketkeeper.
Smith on 98. He turns that way into the onside. This could be it. He's played it four a square. He's coming back for the second. And this time he's got it. He's got into the 90s at Esperstone. He tried to go to his 100 with a 6. This time more cautious. He's taken his 100.
It's a pretty incredible feeling, missing out last time at Edgbaston. You always have that little niggling thing in the back of your head that always says that, you know, what could have been. But yeah, it's a great feeling.
24-year-old Jamie Smith eventually dismissed for 111, his maiden test century, England totalling 358 in their first innings in the first test against Sri Lanka. It means that in his opening five test innings, Smith has now scored 318 runs, the second most by any wicketkeeper in test history. Little wonder that England's record scorer, Sir Alistair Cook, watching on, was hugely impressed.
He's made a fantastic start to his test career, and obviously getting so close in the previous series against West Indies in 95 to get over it. It is important as a batsman to get that milestone. I think what we've all seen in this short test career, this guy's here to stay. He'll have some slightly tougher challenges and there will be some dips in form, but he's got a very simple technique. He seems to have all the shots to both seam and spin. And I like the fact that he can change his tempo. He goes up and down gears depending on the situation, plays the situation incredibly well, and that your margin for error when you bowl at him, there isn't a big margin for error, because bowlers, when they know that, when they stand at the top of the mark, that puts him instantly under a bit of pressure.
How ready is he, though, for the likes of Cummins, Stark, Hazelwood, Bumrah? You know, there's a big difference, surely, between the West Indies and Sri Lanka and Australia and India.
Yeah, there is. But that's the next part of his challenge. But every bit of me who's watched him play, yes, it'll be tougher for him, but he's coped every challenge so far in his career with aplomb. He scored a lot of county runs as well, went for England Lions, dominated England Lions, so the step up doesn't seem to faze him, and mentally he looks ready. So yes, it'll be a challenge for him, but I think he'll be able to cope, and I think the sight of him scoring 100 today, I think we'll see plenty more.
What difference does it make to a batsman to get a century so early on? He's not a recognised batter, but here he is as the wicketkeeper scoring a big one.
I think he had already done it, was you've earned the respect of the change room. And I think that is actually, and as much as for the other people, but for him, when you sit there and you know you can play at this level and you feel like you belong in the side, it's just another little hurdle into making yourself feel more comfortable at the test level.
So all of which means the fourth day of the match, which starts at 11 o'clock here at Old Trafford, with Sri Lanka resuming their second innings on 204 for 6. They lead by 82. Test match special from 10:30 on BBC Sounds. TV highlights from the BBC iPlayer from 7. Elsewhere, England's Charlie Hull is 3 shots off the lead at the halfway stage of the Women's Open Golf at St Andrews. She was round in level par 72. The world number one Nelly Korda, though, clear with a round of 68. The world number one tennis player, Jannik Sinner, says he's no longer working with his physio or fitness trainer following that investigation into his positive test for a banned substance. You remember he was cleared of fault or negligence by a tribunal last week for, quote, his inadvertent contamination. And one football result significant in Yorkshire. Leeds were comfortable 2-0 winners of the derby in the Championship, a first home defeat of the season for Sheffield Wednesday. And we're staying in Yorkshire. Final day of the York Ebor Festival. Try these two selections. The 3 o'clock, number 8, Lake Forest, and then the next race, 3:35, also number 8, Magical Zoe.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan in Old Trafford for us today. Tomorrow is Broadcasting House. Here's Paddy O'Connell with details of that.
Hello. Weekend storms hit travel and festivals. We've a live weather watch and the BH Top 10 tent pitch tips in the rain. Pensioners and Labour, the tensions increase along with the price cap. We contrast next week's Paralympic hopes with the marathon task of actually moving a wheelchair on a normal cluttered pavement. And we've the 102-year-old attempting her first skydive on Sunday. BH is on air itself from 9 on Radio 4 and always on BBC Sounds.
And well, I look forward to that tomorrow. And I mean, I'm supposed to bring you the weather, but it's such bad news to bring you on a bank holiday weekend, but I'm sure you're looking out the window. Today, heavy rain will clear eastward from the south, leaving sunny spells and showers. Further north, sunny spells, patchy cloud and scattered showers. But later, it will clear up in the east with a few showers in the west. You're listening to Today with Milice Doucette and Simon Jack.
Now the headlines. Police in Germany are hunting a man who stabbed to death 3 people at a festival in the western city of Solingen. Several others were wounded during the event, which was celebrating the city's 650th anniversary. The mayor said people were in shock, horror and grief. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has appeared on stage alongside Donald Trump after scrapping his independent campaign for the White House and endorsing the Republican candidate. Mr. Trump promised to release files about the assassination of Mr. Kennedy's uncle, John F. Kennedy. The former presenter of The One Show and Match of the Day, Jermaine Genus, has said he's deeply sorry for what he called a huge error of judgment in sending inappropriate texts to 2 colleagues. In an interview with the Sun newspaper, the 41-year-old, who was sacked by the BBC, said he accepted he had fallen below standards of the corporation and felt ashamed for letting everybody down. The government's given the Infected Blood Compensation Authority the power to make payments to those affected by the scandal. The 30,000 people were infected with hepatitis B and C and HIV when they were given contaminated blood products. But sufferers of hepatitis C have complained about the differences in proposed compensation between groups of patients. There are reports that the authorities in Italy are to launch a manslaughter investigation into the deaths of 7 people who were on board a luxury yacht which sank off the coast of Sicily on Monday. The technology entrepreneur Mike Lynch and his daughter were among the dead. Yesterday, Hannah Lynch's body became the final one to be recovered from the vessel. A new law comes into force today, which would see anyone found guilty of stealing a cat or dog in England and Northern Ireland facing up to 5 years in prison. Previously, pet theft would have been treated in the same way as other thefts. And Somerset House in central London is fully reopening to the public today for the first time since it was damaged by a fire last weekend. The fire brigade is continuing to investigate the cause.
Thanks, Alan. 25 to 8. Interest rates are set to fall in the world's biggest economy, according to the chairman of the US Central Bank, Jerome, or Jay Powell. He says the time has come for rates to fall. Many think he left it too late. And there was a very sharp market tantrum a couple of weeks ago when weak employment data suggested the US might be heading for a recession. To work out what that means for the rest of the world, I've been talking to Mohamed El Arian, president of Queen's College at the University of Cambridge and former bond market supremo.
He means that the time has come to start a cycle of cuts in interest rates. Why now? For two reasons. One, he is more confident, his word, he's more confident that inflation will get to 2%. And second, he's worried about unemployment. He doesn't want to damage the labour market more than it has been damaged so far.
And we saw a bit of a tantrum in the markets a couple of weeks ago when we had some weak labour data and there was a lot of fear that the Fed had left it too late to cut interest rates. It seems to have ironed itself out now. Have they left it too late? What's their mission now?
So if I had been them, I would have started cutting in July. They will now start cutting in September. Is it a huge difference? No. But the market has done two things. One has put growth right on the middle of its radar screen. And as you said, a few weeks ago, it had a major growth scare that led to quite a sell-off in markets. And second, the market has rushed to price in a very aggressive set of interest rate cuts, a full 2 percentage points for the next year. I suspect that's beyond what the Federal Reserve wants to do, but the market is very eager to see interest rates come down.
Is he caving to market pressure? Are the markets dictating monetary policy, interest rate policy?
I suspect to some extent. In fact, the markets reacted quite enthusiastically to his comments, pushing even further this notion that we are on the cusp, not just of an interest rate cycle, but a very aggressive interest rate cycle. Having said that, the time has come for him to cut interest rates. And the most likely mistake he would have made was to be too late rather than to be too early in cutting rates.
If I'm sitting in the UK or in Europe somewhere, why do I care about what the Federal Reserve is doing? What does it mean for the rest of the world?
So the Federal Reserve is the most powerful central bank because the dollar is a reserve currency and because many countries outsource their savings to the US. So it is important what the Fed does. And by doing what Powell did on Friday, he basically opened the door wide open for other countries and other central banks to start cutting rates aggressively.
Andrew Bailey spoke soon after Jerome Powell. What did we learn from him?
We learned two things. One, like Powell, he welcomed the progress made against inflation, noting in particular that the persistent element had become less threatening. But two, he was much more cautious about the outlook and didn't follow Powell in signaling very strongly a major interest rate cut. He was much more cautious, saying that the Bank of England may have to maintain restriction for longer.
Is that one of the reasons why the pound is strengthening against the dollar? Because people think that interest rate cuts will be slower in the UK than in the US?
Yes. This interest rate differential is seen now to favor the UK going forward. And that explains why the pound and other currencies have strengthened. In fact, the dollar has depreciated to levels that we haven't seen for over 14 months.
So in the US, is the danger you let the inflation genie out of the bottle again?
That is a risk, but it's a risk worth taking. Because the other risk is you stay tight for too long, you cause unemployment to go up. And unemployment is not linear. It starts creeping up. And then as people worry about their jobs and as businesses worry about their prospects, unemployment can shoot up. So, yeah, there clearly are risks, but they are two-sided. And the judgment now is the risk of high unemployment is more severe than the risk of higher inflation.
The Federal Reserve is independent. Jay Powell obviously talks to the president of the day. Donald Trump has talked about taking over the Federal Reserve and has some policies which some people have seen as potentially inflationary. How important is independence of central banks? Because it hasn't always been this way.
It hasn't. And the Bank of England led the way in getting independence from the government under Gordon Brown. It is very important because central banks can be abused by governments. That's the history. Governments can pursue short-term objectives of sprinting for growth by injecting a lot of liquidity. And if central banks aren't independent, they will have quite an inflationary bias. So it is very important. I do not believe that what former President Trump said about taking control of the Fed is ever going to happen. Congress will not allow it.
When you look at the election, what does an economist like yourself think are the stakes here in the US election?
I think the economy remains the number one issue for many people, for many voters. The Democrats are hoping that the economy will remain relatively strong. Republicans are hoping that the economy will weaken and that they can blame that on the administration. Right now, the administration is pleased that inflation has come down to below 3%, but is worried about the growth outlook.
And what about the future of the dollar? Because the national debt in the US has climbed, I think I remember talking to you about a few years ago when it was 20 trillion and now it's 30-something trillion. Is there any limit to how much money the rest of the world will lend Uncle Sam before the dollar becomes vulnerable?
That is an issue. It would have been unthinkable for the United States to have 30 straight months of unemployment of 4% or below, and yet have a very large fiscal deficit of 6 to 7% of GDP. When it's sunny, as President Kennedy said once, you're supposed to fix the roof, not put more holes in the roof. And that's what the U.S. has done. Having said that, the U.S. can abuse its position for quite a long time because the dollar is the reserve currency and because no other financial system attracts as much money. But it's got to be careful.
Mohammed, thank you so much.
Mohammed El-Erian there, the advisor to Allianz and the president of Queen's College at Cambridge.
We've reported on this programme about a fundraiser to rescue a library and community hub set on fire during the recent disorder in Liverpool. Now the fundraiser has been paused because it's been so successful. The fundraiser for the Spello Library Hub has raised more than £250,000. We're joined by the woman who set up the effort, 27-year-old Alex McCormick, a manicurist from Netherton. Alex, well done.
Oh, thank you so much.
I think at the beginning you said, well, I hope to raise £500. What do you think happened?
So the initial target was 500, and the plan was just to replace the books that had been burned. I never imagined it would go as crazy as it has, to be honest, but I think everyone has got a connection to a library or a book that they love, or a community space that's benefited them. So I think people were just really hurt by what has happened to Spello, and just it just went from there, really.
Yeah, the images on social media were absolutely heartbreaking. And in addition to the money, you've also been receiving books. How many? Do you have a sense?
I couldn't even put a number on it. But the donations have been unbelievable. Too many books for one library, if that's even possible.
Oh, good. So other libraries can benefit. Really, really, really touched by your effort. You obviously love books. So we'd like to get you to give tick off today's summer book club. We've been talking to authors Fang Cottrell Boyce and Cressida Cowell about the best books to keep children well read and happy over the holidays. This week's theme is nature. We're going to hear a few more recommendations from our listeners in a moment. But Alex, I understand you have a 2-year-old. What would you recommend as a book?
I do. So my little girl's favourite book at the minute is Monkey Puzzle by Julia Donaldson. We read it about 100 times a day in this house.
You must know it by heart.
I think I do at this point.
Yes. Alex, thank you. And keep going. Thank you so much for joining us. Alex McCormick.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us.
It's 7:45.
So we're going to, Alex's 2-year-old isn't the only one with a passion for nature-themed summer read. This was the suggestion from one of our listeners, Gwyneth Hill.
The nature book I'd like to recommend is Life on the Thames by Emma Shord. My 7-year-old nature-obsessed grandson, who is lucky to live by the river, loves this beautifully illustrated record of life on the Thames, from its source to the sea. Together with its history, and importantly, our interaction with the river today.
Lovely. And this from a listener in the Shetlands.
My name's Katrina Waddington. I strongly recommend Sally and the Limpet by Simon James. The grown-ups didn't know what to do when Sally got a limpet stuck to her finger, but young Sally works it out for herself. She just needs to immerse her finger back in the seawater. Much better and more limpet-friendly than the silly suggestions made by the doctor and Sally's family. It's delightful, and with a deeper meaning too. I love the way that Sally has more of an understanding of nature than the grown-ups.
Silly, silly us. This from another listener.
Good morning, my name is Jackie Pierce. I would like to recommend a modern-day adventure set in nature for the Children's Book Club, The Boy Who Hid in the Woods by Nicola Wirral. It's a great adventure about a boy living amongst nature here in the UK. I've shared it with my nieces and nephews and they all enjoyed it so much they couldn't put it down. Many thanks and happy reading.
Happy reading to all of our listeners and their children.
It is 13 minutes to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Director of the Religion and Society think tank Theos, Chinny MacDonald.
Good morning. I've watched with fascination the electrifying words from the Democratic National Convention this week, including Kamala Harris's speech of a lifetime to accept her party's nomination to be the next president of the United States. Democrats, just like the Republicans a few weeks before, use their conventions to inspire their base and give a glimpse into what it is they're about, how they believe the world should be, and what they will do to make their vision a reality. Stars of politics, film, music and entertainment took to the stage with carefully crafted lines delivered with religious fervour, the likes of which have been seen in pulpits around the world, from abolition to the civil rights movement. I've long been fascinated by the power of speech to change hearts and minds. Every summer for the past 13 years I've come to Greenbelt Festival, where I am now, to have my mind changed. Started 50 years ago, this Arts, Faith and Justice Festival has welcomed performances from artists such as U2, Laura Mvula and Labi Siffre. But it's the talks I come here for, to have my mind expanded by listening to well-known thinkers such as Gordon Brown, Rowan Williams or economist Kate Raworth. This weekend I'll hear new and probably uncomfortable perspectives from former BBC Reith lecturer Darren McGarvey. Political rallies like the Democratic National Convention this week, electrifying though they may have been, often speak to crowds of people who already agree with them. But maybe in our increasingly polarised world, we need oratory that breaks out of the echo chamber, that connects rather than divides. One of my favourite passages of scripture is found in the book of Acts, where Paul is invited to the Areopagus, the meeting place of the most powerful men in Athens, where different ideas were discussed and debated. They told Paul they wanted to hear more of his strange ideas about God. Paul's speech is a masterclass in oratory. He doesn't just use fancy words, but appeals to the values of the Athenians, their own culture, their own poets, to turn their minds and their hearts to his point of view. Some of them sneered, yes, but some of them wanted to hear more. The best and most persuasive oratory is ultimately about connecting to people where they are. This too lies at the heart of the Christian faith, where God steps into the everyday, what Christians call incarnation. It's not about enforcing ideas, but about changing the world through connection and relationship. As Abraham Lincoln once said, "If you wish to win a man over to your ideas, first make him your friend."
And that was Thought for the Day with Director of the Religion and Society think tank Theos, Chinny MacDonald. It is just past 10 to 8.
This month marks 3 years since the Taliban returned to power in Afghanistan. Before they took over, some of their leaders kept saying the movement had changed, they were more educated since their draconian rule of the mid-1990s. But with every year, there are signs that it's just as severe, if not worse. Their first formal declaration of what they call vice and virtue laws has now been issued. For men, it's rules like how to shave their beard and not to play music in the car. For women, it deepens the erasure of women and girls from public life. Article 13, for example, says a face covering is essential to avoid temptation and tempting others. Article 19 says women cannot travel on their own, and they must also not speak loudly at home to prevent their voices from being heard outside. We're joined now by Shukriya Barakzai. She's a former member of the Afghan Parliament and a former ambassador of Afghanistan during the governments, of course, before the Taliban came back to power. Welcome to the programme, Shukriya Barakzai.
Good morning, Liz.
So at last count, before this new register was issued, there were about 70 edicts restricting the lives of women and girls. How much worse does it get with these new laws?
As you read and give some example, this is the most shocking decree that comes by Taliban. The one that even they don't have the definition of their government. Like because as everyone is aware, they don't have, the Taliban government don't have any constitution. But when it comes to put women more in a side and corner, they issued more than 85 verbal and written decrees. And the last one, the one you mentioned, that is the most aggressive one. Because even the voice of women, when voice of someone could be counted as a crime, if someone just because speaking to someone, for instance, a woman were going for shopping and etc., and that could be counted as a crime when she's speaking or buying something. And that will give space and authority to the voice and virtual police and even the taxi driver, shopkeeper, male family member and everyone. So they will punish her. This has never happened in the history of human that women's and the entire world and the human history to be punished just because of their voice or while they're speaking to someone. It seems to me that even breathing oxygen is going to be difficult for women in Afghanistan because at the moment, they are not counting as a human being. They are not really second or third citizens. It seems to me they are not citizen anymore. Women are become very items and objectives and where whatever Taliban love to do with them, they can do.
Now, the Taliban say repeatedly that they are doing this because this is both law, Islamic law and the customs of Afghanistan. They say they're doing it, in their words, to protect women. When you speak to women in Afghanistan, what impact is this having on them to live, to try to live under this huge weight?
Is Afghanistan the only Islamic country in the earth? Is there any other country having such rules as Taliban says? Is Islam banned women from education? Is Islam banned women's voice from the normal public life? Is that Islam that Taliban are practicing? Or this is something completely different? When I'm teaching online back home, young girls, university students, it's so difficult these to understand what exactly they are feeling. You know how difficult it is to be count a criminal or to be punished just because of your gender or your sex because they are just female? It's so rational to see this gender apartheid.
Yes.
It's so difficult to believe that. To just be punished because no one have the choice to make their gender.
Yeah, the UN has been reporting for many months now that the rising incidence of suicide and attempts at suicide. But what is the way forward, Shakuya Balakzai? Earlier in the week, we had on this program the UN Special Rapporteur for Afghanistan, Richard Bennett, talking about how he has been banned from visiting Afghanistan. He takes a very tough line. You use the word gender apartheid. He's been describing the situation as gender apartheid, wants it to be codified into law. And yet we see other UN officials and bodies talking about the need to engage with the Taliban, to sit down with the Taliban. What is the way to resolve this?
I think it will be very disappointing to see still normalization with Taliban and engagement with Taliban will continue. At least if we sit and judge the 3 years of Taliban behavior and their rules and regulation towards human rights and women's rights and their behavior generally to the people of Afghanistan, it's very disappointing. And I think that disappointment comes as a result of normalization. I think it's time to hold Taliban accountable. It's time to talk with those countries and authorities where they are about to recognize or give money and a base of weekly to the Taliban. It's time to for the United Nations to take a really serious and major steps for the sake of rights of Afghan people as a global citizens.
Well, what do you say, Shakuya, to those who say, well, we can't, you know, the people of Afghanistan, many now are living on the edge, they need humanitarian aid, that the world cannot abandon them. They have to deal with the top. What do you say to that?
It's very different between sending and supporting humanitarian aids and political engagement, recognition and normalization relationship with the Taliban. There should be a clear definition how, even a clarity, justice and equal distribution needs to be considered on humanitarian aid. And those aid shouldn't go to the pockets of Taliban. This is what we want to ask. Some monitor and needs to be done. But it doesn't mean that they should give everything to the hands of Taliban and under name of humanitarian aid, they should normalize their relationship with the Taliban.
Shukran Balakzai, I'm sorry, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you.
It is time for a look at this morning's weather. Elizabeth Rossini in the BBC Weather Centre is there for us. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Hello, good morning again. Well, it's still breezy today following Storm Lillian yesterday and also rather cool for the time of year. It's wet too in the south. So today, then, for South East Wales, for Southern England, the Midlands, East Anglia, parts of Yorkshire too this morning, cloudy outbreaks of rain. Some of the rain likely to be heavy, particularly for parts of South East England and East Anglia. We could see quite a lot of rain within a short space of time, maybe leading to some localised flooding. Then that rain will start to clear away into the North Sea by the time we get to the afternoon. Sunny spells behind the front, but also the chance of some heavy thundery showers, particularly for central and eastern areas of England. For North West Wales, Northern England and Scotland, also for Northern Ireland, it's a day of sunny spells and some heavy, possibly thundery showers. Most of those showers will be across North West Scotland. And it's also windy too here. Lighter winds developing elsewhere, but still a brisk southwesterly turning westerly wind. And it's cool today for August as well, 16 to 19 Celsius for England and Wales. Locally, 20 or 21 degrees Celsius and the best of the sunshine. That's probably most likely for eastern Wales and into the Midlands. And just 14 to 17 Celsius in Scotland and Northern Ireland. It's all leading on to a rather chilly feeling night.
On BBC iPlayer.
We are not in control of this situation.
We know that these shootings are very upsetting for the community.
It's a gathering storm and I'm worried about anyone who's at the centre of it.
There will be consequences.
In this culture or code of not grassing, we are way beyond that now.
They're all turning on each other.
This ends before it begins.
Revenge runs in the family. I go down, you go down.
Blood for blood.
Put them down.
We've been in danger before.
But this is different, Rory. Look at me. This is different.
Sherwood, Series 2.
It's on a knife edge out there.
Starts tomorrow on BBC iPlayer.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Saturday the 24th of August. This is Today with Lise Doucette and Simon Jack.
German police are searching for an attacker who killed three people and wounded several others with a knife at a festival in the city of Solingen. Robert Kennedy Jr. has appeared at a campaign rally alongside Donald Trump after he scrapped his own independent bid to be the next US president. Sir Keir Starmer has restated the UK's support for Ukraine as the country marks the 33rd anniversary of its independence from the Soviet Union.
Also in today's programme, as the government summons energy providers to a meeting next week, what should be done about this winter's higher bills? How Kamala Harris has been shunning journalists and giving her time to social influencers, and Bristol's alive with the sound of the BBC Proms. We'll speak to the man in charge of making it all happen.
I'm Jonathan Urquhart at Old Trafford, where the new man in charge of England's cricket team is aiming to close out victory against Sri Lanka today in his first match in the job.
Thanks, Jonathan. The BBC News this morning read by Alan Smith.
Police in Germany are searching for a man who fatally stabbed three people in the western city of Solingen. Five others were seriously wounded. Witnesses have reported that a man attacked passers-by at random during events marking the anniversary of the city's founding. His motive is not clear. Damien McGuinness reports from Berlin.
Solingen is in a state of shock this morning after three people were killed in a stabbing at a local festival last night. The attacker, who is still on the run, appears to have been acting alone. Police have blocked off roads and have asked eyewitnesses to contact them directly with any information or pictures via a special hotline. It's still not clear what was behind the attack, and politicians have called on people to avoid any speculation, saying there's so far no evidence about who the perpetrator was. According to one German media report, the attacker stabbed people indiscriminately with a knife. The region's leader, Hendrik Wüst, called the stabbing a brutal and senseless act of violence.
Robert F. Kennedy has appeared on stage with Donald Trump after abandoning his own independent bid for the White House and throwing his support behind the former president. Mr. Kennedy, a member of America's most storied political family, said he no longer had a realistic path to victory, with polls suggesting his support had dwindled to less than 5%. Here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
Both Robert F. Kennedy's uncle, John, and his father, Robert, were assassinated during a period of political turbulence that rocked this country in the 1960s. And last month, Donald Trump himself was also the subject of an attempt on his life. On stage in Arizona, he announced the formation of an independent commission that would be tasked with releasing all the remaining documents relating to the death of John F. Kennedy back in 1963. Mr. Trump praised his newest supporter, saying his campaign had inspired people.
He knows firsthand the risks incurred by leaders who stand up to the corrupt political establishment. But I will tell you, we are both in this to do what's right for the country.
Robert Kennedy Jr. entered the presidential race as a Democrat before switching to become an independent, and his endorsement of Donald Trump injects a new dose of uncertainty into what has become a tight race for the White House.
The presenter and football pundit Jermaine Genus has said he feels deeply ashamed after he was sacked by the BBC for sending inappropriate messages to female colleagues. In an interview with the Sun newspaper, the former footballer apologises to the women for making them feel uncomfortable, and to his wife. Will Vernon has more details.
In his interview, Jermaine Genus accepts he sent inappropriate text messages to two female colleagues on The One Show and says he recognises his behaviour fell below the standards of the BBC. He says he's sorry for what he calls mistakes and asks his family for forgiveness.
This is completely on me. I am 100% in the wrong and I accept full responsibility for that. And it's something that obviously I need to address and look at myself.
Jermaine Genus also claims he is not a sex pest and says the texts were between consenting adults. The Sun says he is now considering suing the BBC for their handling of the scandal. On Thursday, the corporation announced it had sacked the former footballer from The One Show and Match of the Day. The BBC has been keen to show it can act quickly when such accusations arise after being criticised for its response to allegations of inappropriate behaviour on Strictly Come Dancing.
The body set up to provide compensation to victims of the infected blood scandal has been given the power to start making payments. 30,000 people were infected with HIV and hepatitis C after treatment with contaminated blood products. 3,000 of them died. But as our health editor Hugh Pym reports, some groups are unhappy with the amounts on offer.
After a campaign lasting decades, a public inquiry concluded in May that doctors, governments and the NHS had repeatedly failed victims. Now the Infected Blood Compensation Authority has been formally set up. The first payments to those infected will start at the end of the year. The Hepatitis C Trust said people had waited too long, though it was welcome that the new body had been established at long last. But the Trust went on to say there were still concerns at the disparities in the proposed compensation for people with hepatitis viruses and HIV. A spokesperson said many given hepatitis C in infected blood did not find out till many years afterwards and were having to live with the long-term consequences such as cirrhosis and liver cancer. The Trust added that it was hard to understand why they should receive lower compensation, and without a fair scheme, many would face further delays to justice. A government spokesperson said advice on compensation payments had come from an expert advisory group.
Prosecutors in Sicily are expected to outline the initial findings of their investigation into the sinking of the superyacht Bazian this morning. Seven people died when the vessel went down during a storm off the coast of the island on Monday. Those killed included the British tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch and his daughter Hannah. 15 people were rescued. Sir Keir Starmer has promised that the UK will back the people of Ukraine today and always as the country celebrates 33 years since it declared independence from the Soviet Union. Separately, the Defence Secretary, John Healey, has suggested that Ukraine's incursion into Russian territory has sown doubt in Moscow about President Putin's leadership. Our political correspondent Helen Catt reports.
The UK has been a staunch backer of Ukraine since the Russian invasion, and Labour has been keen to make clear that a change of government does not mean a change in approach. Sir Keir said he had a crystal clear message to all Ukrainians, whether they were on the front line or here in what he described as their second home in the UK. That message, he said, was that the UK was with them today and always. Writing in The Telegraph, the Defence Secretary John Healey claimed that Ukraine's operation in the Kursk region had sown doubt inside Russia and exposed what he called Putin's Kremlin cabal to the consequences of their aggression.
Anyone found guilty of stealing a cat or dog in England and Northern Ireland could now face up to 5 years in prison under a new law that's come into force. Previously, the theft of a household animal was treated in the same way as the stealing of an object. Katrina Renton reports.
During lockdown, the UK government set up the Pet Theft Task Force due to a perception of an increase of dogs and cats being stolen. Its findings suggested in 2020 there were around 2,000 dog thefts reported to police in England and Wales and more than 400 cats stolen across the UK. Until now, pets were treated under the definition of property for legal purposes. The law is similar in Scotland. The new legislation recognises cats and dogs as sentient beings instead of inanimate objects. Campaigners have been calling for stronger penalties that reflect the emotional value of pets to their owners and the distress associated with their theft. Anyone convicted of stealing a cat or a dog could now face a fine or a maximum of 5 years in prison. There are also powers in the legislation to extend it to other pets if necessary. It was one of the final bills passed before the general election in July.
The Paralympic flame will be lit at Stoke Mandeville in Buckinghamshire today. It'll then begin its journey to Paris, where the Paralympic Games are due to get underway on Wednesday. More details from our sports correspondent Andy Swiss.
The flame will be lit by two British Paralympians, rower Helene Rainsford and wheelchair curler Gregor Ewan, as it starts its journey at the birthplace of the Paralympic movement. It was back in 1948 that Stoke Mandeville hosted the first competition for wheelchair athletes, an event which developed into the Paralympic Games. The flame will travel to France through the Channel Tunnel. At the tunnel's halfway point, 24 British torchbearers will hand it on to a group of French torchbearers. When it arrives in Calais, it'll be split into 12 separate flames, which will then be taken around France. They'll eventually converge in Paris for the opening ceremony on Wednesday, where the Paralympic cauldron will be lit.
That was Andy Swiss.
And we'll be talking to Tanny Gray-Thompson about the Paralympics getting underway next week, just at 10 to 9. But for now, most benefits are means tested. That's how you target them at the people who need them the most. But winter fuel payments were not. Since it's being introduced by the Blair government in 1997, every pensioner household in England and Wales got up to £300 a year until now. Rachel Reeves announced that winter fuel payments will be means tested from this autumn. Those not on pension credit or other means tested benefits will no longer get those annual payments. Now, that decision was thrown into sharp relief yesterday when Ofgem announced that energy bills would be going up by 10% this winter. So a double whammy for millions, higher bills, less support. Meanwhile, Energy Secretary Ed Miliband said bills would be lower if we were less reliant on the fossil fuels whose rising prices are behind the energy cap hike. Now, the government last night summoned energy providers to a meeting next week to discuss how to help people get through this winter. Emma Pinchbeck, Chief Executive of Energy UK, which represents energy providers, told PM what she would say to people who suspect companies are profiteering.
I can completely understand why people are thinking that. The fact of the matter is that energy retail, they make very little profit. And over the 5 years I've been doing this job, most of the time their margins have been negative. That's because, a bit like everyone else, they are the ones buying the gas on the market to sell to customers. And under the price cap, the profit they can make is regulated. It is true that oil and gas companies and others who sell gas, particularly when prices have been high, have made big profits through the energy crisis. That's often what you see reflected in when you're hearing hearing kind of stories of record profits. Amongst other things, we've supported windfall levies where appropriate to make sure that companies are not just profiting from the crisis, but profiting where they should be from, you know, proper innovation, good customer service, and an effective market. One thing that is really important to say to anyone that's struggling with their energy bill is that the suppliers have help available for anyone in need in the form of everything from payment plans to bill relief. You should be contacting your supplier in the first instance if you are worried about paying your bill.
Emma Pinchbeck from Energy UK there. Well, let's talk to Age UK. Paul Farmer is the chief executive of that. And on the winter fuel payments, most benefits are means tested. What's your reaction to the idea that the winter fuel allowance should be means tested?
Well, we are extremely concerned about the 2 million older people who will miss out on the winter fuel credit in particular, winter fuel payment in particular this year. We think the announcement is far too soon, far too quick to be able to give older people the chance to be able to make the changes that they need, but also for the system to be able to cope with what's almost certainly going to happen. And yesterday's announcement is just a further terrible blow to the many older people who are really going to struggle this winter. This is probably the fifth winter in a row that older people are really going to struggle. Yeah. So the whole idea of means testing may be worth considering, but you can't simply turn a universal system into a means tested system overnight without significant consequences to many people who are on the margins of this.
Because just to put this in context, bills will be higher than they were earlier in the year, but they will be lower than they were this time last year. Nevertheless, you say the £300 to some households will hit a lot of people in the pocket.
Since the original announcement, we've been overwhelmed by calls, 40% increase in calls to our national advice service, 200% increase in use of our online benefits calculation. And just, I'm in Devon at the moment, and I just with our team, and I heard yesterday about a caller who's 73 years old. He's just above that pension credit line. The pension credit line, people may not know, is about £11,000. So if you're above that line, you won't get pension credit. This gentleman was in a terrible state. He said he'd broken down in tears several times as a result of this news. Mm. And yes, you're right. The previous year's bills were slightly different, but don't forget, an awful lot of older people also benefited from a cost of living payment support last year, which is now going away. So if you like, it's not just the £300 of winter fuel credit, it's also the 300 additional pounds that many older people received last year. Yeah. So however way you look at it, around about 2 million older people will be significantly worse off. And, you know, we're in August now, and of course we've got no idea what this year's winter is going to look like.
But you do accept, I think what I heard you saying is that you accept the principle of means testing. You don't think that the speed with which this has been done is correct. Is that your position?
Well, we want the Chancellor to reverse this particular decision at this particular moment, because we believe that the unintended consequences on this 2 million group of people is too great. Right.
But you will accept that there are lots of quite affluent pensioners out there, some of whom don't need it. If you're not going to means test it, how on earth do you make sure that the money you get at a time when the public finances are stretched gets to the people who need it the most and not to those who don't need it?
Yeah, we're not in the medium term. There's no question that there's an argument for looking at the way in which this money is distributed. Now, it is currently a universal benefit, but we know that over many years, government's ability to means test benefits has been extremely variable in its success rate. And if you are going to make such a big switch, then you need to take some additional time into looking at this, including taking the opportunity to look at opportunities to look at a social tariff for energy, as well as the potential to think about how to help older people insulate their homes better. So if we take a much more rounded view to this issue, then I think we could come up with a solution that would be better for older people and also better for the taxpayer.
Yeah, because you make the point there that not all, you know, it's not just pensioners who are on low incomes. In fact, pensioner incomes are pretty much the same as those of working age incomes, well, according to the Institute for Fiscal Studies, after many years of things like the triple lock, whatever, pensioners are not a sort of outlier in terms of being low income people.
No, that's right. And this is why it's important for people to bear in mind that the support that older people need is still very much there. And we also know that a lot of older people have spent more of their savings as a result of the cost of living, the last 2 years of the cost of living crisis. So we're talking mainly here about people in their 70s, 80s and 90s who are very unlikely to be able to find any other way of generating income. So they are reliant on this money to be able to keep their homes this year.
Yeah.
I think if we took a longer term view on this and came up with a much more rounded support that recognised some of the wider energy issues, then I think this would be a win for older people. Mm. But you can't do that in a matter of weeks before this winter arrives.
One point that I've heard Paul Lewis, who does Moneybox, make in the past, is that if you means test things and make people have to claim it, a lot of people don't claim it, whether it's been pride or the process is difficult. And that it is true, is it not, that there's almost 900,000 people who are eligible for pension credit who don't actually get it?
Yes, that's absolutely right. If you ask people to claim things, it's difficult to do that. The pension credit form is 243 questions. It is easier to fill in online than it is in paper. We know an awful lot of older people in this particular group struggle with digital access. There are many barriers in the way of people for people to fill in this particular form in this particular way. And yes, there are nearly a million people who could be entitled to claim pension credit. And we are already work at Age UK. A lot of the work we do, both nationally and locally, supports older people to do that. Mm. But we don't have the capacity to be able to do that to the scale that we know is about to hit us as more people try to claim. Yes. So that is a real issue for how you create a fair and equitable system for older people to be able to receive the support which they really need to be able to survive. And the impact, by the way, on other public services, particularly the NHS, will need to be considered this winter as well.
Okay. Paul Farmer, Chief Executive of Age UK, thank you for that.
It's 19 minutes past 8, and what could be better than the BBC Proms in the Royal Albert Hall in London? Well, how about a whole bank holiday of the orchestral proms? The Bristol Beacon is hosting 6 performances over 3 days, and it's the first full-scale orchestral proms in the Southwest. We're joined by Simon Wales. He's the CEO of the Bristol Beacon. Simon, I'm tempted to say, well, why bring the proms to Bristol? And I expect your answer is, why not? What's the response been?
That is definitely my answer, why not? This has been a long discussion that we've been having with the BBC to make Bristol Beacon one of the major residencies outside of London for the proms, and we're delighted to have these 6 proms over the bank holiday weekend. And this is exactly the kind of thing that Bristol Beacon has been redeveloped to be able to host.
A beacon indeed. Well, the first concert kicks off tonight, and it will be the Virtuous Circle performed by Para Orchestra. It's the UK's only ensemble including disabled and non-disabled professional musicians. Let's listen to a bit of their performance of Mozart's Symphony No. 40. Wow, much tapping of feet here, me and Simon in the studio. We didn't even have to buy a ticket. Tell us about this orchestra.
So Para Orchestra are one of our associate artists, and they're based here in Bristol. And they consider Bristol Beacon really to be their sort of home venue. And the relationship we have with them allows them to be creating and trying out. Almost all of their projects are entirely new creations. And this is the very first time that they're in the BBC Proms as well. So it felt absolutely right that our prom residency should start with our associate artist in the building where they create so much of their work.
And has this been the whole thrust of your preparation, that you wanted not just the location to be different, but actually the whole program to be different?
Yes, I think if we think about what we are here for, accessibility, inclusion, welcome, excellence, all types of music, welcoming all types of audiences. That really does chime with how the BBC Proms is developing as well. So we were very involved in the discussions about what the actual proms should be, and really making sure that that range of proms reflects what we want people to come and experience at Bristol Beacon.
And do you expect it will go beyond Bristol?
So it's just Beacon based at the moment. We're hoping this will be the beginning of a number of years that we can present the proms. We're already in discussions about what next year might entail. So hopefully it can grow.
But this will also be a moment to showcase Bristol as well. You mentioned that the Para Orchestra is a Bristol based orchestra.
That's right. I mean, Bristol is a very creative, very cultural city. There's a huge amount going on in Bristol and all of the Southwest. So it feels absolutely right that we should be one of the host venues for the proms. And we hope that we can include more and more of what is actually happening in Bristol within our prom series. Certainly across our whole year, we present 800 events at Bristol Beacon. And they are local talent. We're developing local audiences, but we have national, international artists as well. So this is a very, you know, hopefully a building that really reflects what's going on in Bristol and the wider region.
It's lovely to hear the excitement in your voice. You are not just a CEO. You sing in a choir as well. So you're very musical. What are you most looking forward to?
Yes, I've been a singer all my life. In fact, I was singing in the BBC Proms last weekend in Britain's War Requiem with the LSO, which was incredible performance. So exciting, so moving. And the response from the audience sort of said it all. And so I'm a singer. So, of course, I'm excited to hear the BBC singers tomorrow in their centenary afternoon performance. And there are masses, as I'm finding out, because I've only just arrived in Bristol. This is my first week in the job.
Oh, my goodness.
There are many, many singing groups in Bristol, and I will definitely be joining one of them, I'm sure.
Thank you so much for sharing all your excitement and joy. Simon Wales, CEO of the Bristol Beacon.
Let us get some sport now. And Jonathan Ledyard is up in Old Trafford, the cricket ground, I should say, this morning. And I suppose the most pressing issue, Jonathan, will be the weather.
Yes. Do you want a quick forecast?
Go on then.
Grey. Cool. We're hoping for sunshine, but we're fearing rain in the next hour, according to my app, because the clouds are brooding overhead. The ground staff have been preparing the pitch meticulously for the last 2 hours. Ollie Pope's England team aiming to close out his first win as captain in the first test against Sri Lanka. Tourists will resume this fourth morning of play on 204 for six. That's a lead of 82. This followed a magnificent first test 100 for England's new wicketkeeper, Jamie Smith.
It's a pretty incredible feeling, missing out last time at Edgbaston. You always have that little niggling thing in the back of your head that always says that, you know, what could have been. But yeah, it's a great feeling.
England totaled 358 in their first innings, all watched by our correspondent Jonathan Agnew. Joins me now. Morning.
Good morning, Jonathan.
So how impressed were you by Jamie Smith?
Oh, I have been all the way through, ever since he appeared on the England scene at the start of this summer. I mean, he's an outstanding cricketer. It was a controversial selection in terms of his wicket-keeping and taking the place of Ben Foulkes, of course, his Surrey teammate, who is preferred to him in county cricket. But that was... I don't think the quality of his batting was never in doubt. I mean, he is an outstanding player. He's got excellent defence. He's got a beautiful hard hit cover drive. He seems to have all bases covered, and he's got all the shots as well, as you know, from white ball cricket. He can go through those gears. He can be a very attacking player. But what England are after is that sort of player batting at number seven, somebody who can lift the tempo, who can take control of a game if he's there with the bowlers, with the lower order. He can farm the strike, hit boundaries. He seems absolutely to fit the bill.
And also, there seemed to be like a refinement, or has been a refinement of Baswell. There's patience as much as the helter-skelter smashing it everywhere.
Well, that's definitely true. And I think the India tour during the winter rather summed that up, in that there was a recklessness to it. that was unnecessary. And I think, you know, Baseball, for what it was more a refreshing of the mind, was more psychological, if you like, clearing away the clutter, the defeats, and more of a positive mental attitude, which they still have, but they have certainly reined back. I mean, I don't think there's any aspect of this game that you could even point a finger at and say, oh, well, that's Baseball. I think that has been parked as far as recklessness on the field has been concerned, but they've kept that positive mindset.
You mentioned the word rain. It's raining now. Anyway, let's carry on. They've just moved the covers over the pitch. Just one other thought. How healthy is it for Test cricket this summer? England are lucky to get 4 days play, never mind five.
Yeah, it's hopeless, isn't it? It's sad, really, that the visiting teams to England this summer, West Indies and Sri Lanka, simply haven't been given enough practice. That's what it comes down to. The schedule is far too congested with white ball cricket, with short form cricket, with franchise cricket, and it's squeezing Test cricket out. It's desperately sad, and that also happens. It's not just here, but it happens when England go away on tour as well. There is just not the preparation required. I mean, Sri Lanka are used to playing in 35 degree heat in Sri Lanka. They're coming here and they're playing in these conditions with just one game behind them. It's not surprising that they're struggling, and the West Indies as well. So, look, sort of banging on the same old drum, really, that the T20 short-form cricket is very good for cricket. Financially, it's very good for cricket. There's just way too much of it. The ministers have got too greedy. They've got too lazy. It's easy to knock out another franchise game and sell it to a television company rather than protect and nurture the game that, after all, we're being told that franchise cricket is supposed to be protecting and supposed to be attracting new customers too. Well, what's the point of all that if there is no Test cricket to bring them to?
Well, hopefully there will be Test cricket. Jonathan Agnew, thank you very much indeed. Leading TMS team from 10:30 this morning. 13 degrees. If you're coming today, bring an umbrella. Just to say also, the world's top golfers playing the Women's Open at St Andrews will be watching the weather as closely as all of us here, because it's been a wet and wild ride so far. Have a listen to England's Charlie Hull, leader after a first round score of 67, then battling to level par 72 yesterday.
I was playing just as well as I did yesterday. I just missed a lot of short putts, missed a couple of 2-footers. Every putt that I missed that was short was inside 4 feet. I just felt with the rain this morning, it was a bit more skiddier, then I didn't really trust my stroke on the short putts. So you can kind of get in the way of yourself, but then I kind of grinded it back on the back nine and I played pretty well and good momentum going in towards tomorrow.
Good luck to her. Three shots behind the world number one, Nelly Korda, alongside the defending champion, Lilia Vu. Commentary on Five Sports Extra from St Andrews and BBC Sport Online. And it's the final day of York's eBall meeting, so try these two in the 3 o'clock at York, number 8, Lake Forest, and then the next race, number 8, Magical Zoe.
And just to lighten the mood there a little bit, there was a tremendous catch in the crowd yesterday, wasn't there? Tell us a little bit about that.
Phenomenal, yes, exactly. A big hit. And it just, this man, and you're well aware, when people go to cricket nowadays, it just seems to be sometimes more about how much ale and how much drinks you can do, as much as trying to catch the ball. But fair play, just put his hand up and bang, it just stuck there. Superb.
Well worth a look if you can see it. He's got pint in one hand, yeah, plucks the ball out of the air with the other, chucks it back to the adulation of everyone around him. Well, whoever he is, well done. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you. It'll be harder today because you'll have an umbrella in one hand too. Well, stay with us here on Radio 4 because at half past 10 this morning, we're back in the kitchen cabinet.
On BBC Radio 4.
I think a soggy bottom is a sign of a good time.
Do you need help perfecting your beef Wellington, or are you on the hunt for the ultimate hot sauce recipe?
So you get a sourness, you get a heat, you get sweet, you get hot, you get everything. Reduce it down, then add a little more rum at the end.
Fear not, for my hungry panel are here to devour your questions, offer up inspiration and dish out some advice of their own.
The back of the plane is more enjoyable for an eating experience because there's more moisture in the air, because there's more bodies, as opposed to first class. So I recommend going economy.
The Kitchen Cabinet with me, Jay Rayner, on Saturday mornings at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Quick look at the weather in the south. Heavy rain will clear eastward, leaving sunny spells and showers further north. Sunny spells, patchy cloud and scattered showers. Later it will clear up in the east with a few showers in the west.
It's 8:30 time, and time you're listening to today on BBC Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Lise Doucette. A summary of the news now from Alan Smith.
German police have launched a manhunt after three people were stabbed to death at a festival in the city of Solingen. Five others were seriously wounded. Witnesses say the attacker stabbed passers-by at random. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has appeared on stage with Donald Trump after abandoning his own bid for the White House. Instead of running as an independent candidate, he's thrown his support behind the former president. The former BBC presenter, Jermaine Jean, has said he owes everyone an apology, especially the women he sent inappropriate texts to. Speaking to The Sun, he said he'd let everyone down. The BBC confirmed this week he'd been sacked. Prosecutors in Italy are preparing to give an update on their investigation to the sinking of a luxury yacht off the coast of Sicily. Seven people died, including the technology tycoon Mike Lynch. And anyone convicted of stealing a pet could face up to 5 years in jail under new laws which come into effect today. Previously, the theft of a cat or dog was treated in the same way as thefts of objects.
Thanks very much indeed, Alan. 28 minutes to nine. Now, this week we learned that something was hailed as a Alzheimer's wonder drug would not be made available on the NHS as it represented poor value for money. Lecanemab does not cure, reverse or halt Alzheimer's. It slows the pace of cognitive decline. It costs around £20,000 per patient per year. Yesterday, we spoke to Scott Mitchell, ambassador for Alzheimer's Research UK, campaigner and husband to the late Dame Barbara Windsor, who had Alzheimer's. He told us what a difference a drug like lecanemab would have made.
3.5 years ago, when I lost Barbara, there wasn't this kind of treatment available. If you would have said to me then, you can have an extra 4 to 6 months of good health and quality of life for her at the beginning of that, I would have bitten your hand off. All I can say is these treatments are going to develop. It's not a case of if now, it's a case of when. I just call upon the watchdog NICE, the government, the pharmaceutical companies. Please, please work together. Please find a way to make this available.
Well, listening to that plea is Helen Knight, Director of Medicines Evaluation at NICE, and is on the line. Helen, good morning to you. Can you talk us through how NICE comes to these decisions? What are the factors that go into it?
Hi, Simon. Hi. Yes, of course I can. It's NICE's role is to get the best care to patients fast and ensure good value for the taxpayer. So the NHS does have a finite budget and therefore we support the NHS to spend that money wisely. We have independent committees at NICE, and when they're looking at these new medicines, what we have to take into account is both the costs and the benefits of a new medicine. And when we say kind of costs and, you know, the cost side associated it, we get factor in, you know, what would be the additional cost to the NHS of providing a new medicine. But we also take account of any cost savings or any resource savings that are associated with a new treatment and carefully balance that against the additional benefit that, that the treatment brings, both to the individual patients and also the quality of life benefits to their carers as well.
Okay, so, I was going to be one of my questions. Do you factor in the carers, their role in all of this? And if you can get medication which reduces the burden on carers, does that go into the equation?
So, yes, we do factor in any kind of improvement in the quality of life for carers, and the cost side associated is, you know, not just NHS costs, but also any cost savings to the social care setting as well. So we try to take a pretty holistic view of, you know, not just the benefits to the patients, but any benefits to the carers as well.
OK. And if this was £10,000, would it get the green light? I mean, where is the threshold? Do you ever go back to a drug company and say, listen, I cannot approve it at this cost. If you can come in here, it's got a fighting chance of making the list.
Yeah. So, you know, our framework at NICE is pretty transparent, and we often have, you know, conversations with the companies about commercial arrangements that may help support access to the drug. So, you know, it's very difficult for me to talk about the cost of the drug because at the moment that price is confidential for the UK at this point. But, you know, we factor it up. I mean, I think what's important to say here is, it's not just a change in the cost that's likely to drive a difference. We'd need to see a significant improvement in the benefits, a significant reduction in the cost of the treatments, and it's that balance between the two.
So are you saying in the case of lecanemab that basically you don't think there's enough of a difference to the quality of life of the individual? You're not getting that much bang for your buck in just having a few months, as you heard Scott Mitchell talking about, Dame Barbara Windsor there?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I did hear the comment and I completely understand that. I mean, it's an emerging field of medicine. And, you know, we're really hopeful that in the future we'll see access to some treatments in this area. But you're right, at the moment with lecanemab, it's such a small benefit here. You know, we're talking about a delay in cognitive decline on average of 4 to 6 months. And I recognise for an individual patient that, you know, that time frame can be really valuable. But when you factor in the cost that the NHS would have to give up from other areas to be able to support access here, the balance is just not positive at this point.
Okay. This is a draft decision. Do you leave the door open to reconsider this?
Yeah, absolutely. The consultation is out for 4 weeks. So we're asking stakeholders, have we taken into account all the evidence? Have we missed any evidence? You know, the evidence does come from the company. It comes from patient groups. It comes from professional groups. But what we want to know is, have we missed anything? And of course, we're liaising closely with the company to make sure that, you know, if there's any additional evidence, we're aware of what's coming in. Mm-hmm. The committee that will then reconsider all the responses to the consultation and then finalise its recommendations for the NHS.
Just on a wider view, you say you've got a fixed budget to work with. And when new drugs come along, if you want to make room for a new drug that you do think gives decent value for money, does that mean it'll force something else out? Is it kind of one in, one out? How does that work?
Well, I mean, that's the theory of the approach that we take. But in reality, NICE isn't responsible for what gets displaced. But what we're aware of is that things will have to be displaced. And that's not NICE's role to kind of, it's very difficult to identify that. But the NHS, you know, obviously has to carefully manage that. If NICE makes a recommendation to support access to a treatment, it has to provide that funding within 90 days. So of course the NHS, you know, we work closely with NHS England to kind of say, you know, we're evaluating these treatments, the system will need to be ready. And then it's for the NHS to actually work through how that money, how that funding is provided.
Okay. Thanks very much indeed. Helen Knight there, the Director of Medicines Evaluation at NICE.
This morning, the front pages of many newspapers are full of tributes to 18-year-old Hannah Lynch, the daughter of the tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch. Hannah's body was the last to be found in the vessel, which sank in a sudden storm off the coast of Sicily last Monday. 7 people were killed in all, including Mike Lynch. 15 passengers were rescued. And this morning, the prosecutor leading the investigation into this tragedy will hold a press conference. Our correspondent Bethany Bell, who's in Sicily, told me what's known so far.
It should be stressed that this investigation is an extremely early stage. We spoke yesterday to a professor of maritime law at the University of Palermo. He says this is an investigation against unknown persons, and that's something that the prosecutor's office does in Italy when they don't know if or whether they should press charges. The approach, he said, allows people to gather as much evidence as possible before potentially pressing charges if that becomes clear. So that's what's happening right now. Investigators are looking into any potentially problematic features of the vessel or any possible culpable behaviour. But it should be said, nobody has been placed under formal investigation so far.
The questions seem to centre around the issue of what measures were taken to mitigate against the bad weather. There were warnings of this sudden storm.
There are many, many things, including that. There are questions about how the boat went down so quickly. Were there other mitigating factors the crew should have taken into account? Whether the yacht should have been in the harbour? Many of these questions. But as I say, at the moment, extremely early stages. It's a question of gathering material. We know that the diving teams that were out there searching for the bodies, we're using small remote control vehicles, little robots, if you like, and they've been taking images, and those images have been given to the prosecutors as part of their investigations. And the professor of maritime law, Nicola Romana, that we spoke to, also said that Italy isn't known for its speedy justice system. He doesn't think they'll have a clear idea about what happened for at least 6 months.
And still such a dark cloud over this small community after this terrible tragedy.
I think people here are still in shock about what happened. They've seen the huge rescue operation that went on, the people trying to salvage the bodies. It's a small community here. Then the foreign press arrives. People here, I think, are in a state of shock.
Bethany Bell, thank you.
Now then, if you haven't heard an interview with Kamala Harris with a journalist, you're not the only one, because she has not submitted herself to a formal interview or press conference in almost a month. But there is one group of people she has put aside some time for. They're the Creators for Kamala, the social media influencers who provide an audience of millions of young people who are given privileged access to the Democratic National Convention in a push for crucial younger voters. Katie Hazeldine has been finding out about them.
As well as the traditional mainstream press, there's been more than 200 TikTokers, influencers and YouTubers broadcasting from the Democratic National Convention this week. It's the first time the party have granted them access to an event of this scale. Not only that, but a handful were given time to film with the Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris herself. One of them is Jack Coyne, a YouTuber with over 200,000 followers, mostly made up of 25 to 35-year-olds.
We got the call on Sunday afternoon saying, can you get here tomorrow? We have a slot for you to talk to the vice president tomorrow. And we talked to her about music. And so we talked to her about some of her favorite songs. I think we were invited because the campaign saw in the past there's a lot of interest in Vice President Harris's music tastes. And they've seen traction on other videos where she's talking about music. And they know we have a really popular channel that celebrates music. So it felt like a good fit for her to get her thoughts out there about music in particular.
Give us a little bit of an insight into the type of conversation that you had with her.
So Trackstar is essentially a game show where we play music for people and they have to tell us who the artist is and who performs the song.
Before we start, just introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Kamala Harris.
Welcome to Trackstar. If you can name the artist, you win $5.
Stevie Wonder.
We talked about when she listens to music and why she listens to it and how it was a big part of her childhood and growing up and shaped her as a person.
And were there any instructions before you went in? Did they say, okay, you can only talk about music? Or was it kind of open to, like, you know, if you want to throw a question in there about her campaign or her policy, what was the vibe like?
Yeah, it was open. They didn't tell us what songs to play or anything like that beforehand. Our audience is looking for storytelling around music. They're not necessarily looking for political stuff, so we really wanted to focus on that aspect.
That's Miles.
Tell me about Miles.
He understood the complexity of music and the moods of it, and he obviously inspired a lot of artists who came after him and who also played with him.
People aren't watching TV in the same way that they used to. They might not be listening to the radio in the same way that they used to. And so it's important, I think, to give voice to people who are creating for those platforms.
Do you think it's important for Kamala's campaign as well?
Hugely important, and I think it's a big part of why she's had success so far, is she is connected with a younger demographic and people who are spending a lot of time on social media platforms. And I think a lot of President Trump's success is also due to the fact that his campaign has been very focused on streaming, on internet creators as well. I think he was one of the people who really tapped into that early on. The Obama campaign before that was really focused on digital, hugely important to focus on.
And the organizers agree. Emily Sung is the press secretary for the Democratic National Convention. We are stood in front of a black curtain, Creator Lounge, this is called. I can't get into that lounge, even though I've asked. They said, no way, you cannot get in because I'm part of the mainstream media. This is for creators. Tell me what is going on behind that curtain.
The Creator Lounge is a dedicated space for content creators. We know that the media landscape has completely transformed since the last time we were here for an in-person convention. And in order to continue reaching new audiences, to continue making sure that our message gets out there, we have brought in creators this year to help to, you know, cover the convention, bring that experience out to the American people.
What is the necessary criteria to be a creator and to be invited here?
There's not specific stipulations. These are people who have their own unique online communities, who some of them cover politics,
politics. Some of them have never covered politics. TikTokers, TikTok dancers.
Is the idea of this to reach those younger audiences? Is that the thinking behind this?
It's certainly a big part of it. We know that young people really use social media as a vessel for information and for news. And so we wanted to make sure we're blanketing the airwaves, blanketing, you know, social media with our content and making sure that this message really breaks through.
You keep mentioning the message about getting the message out. What message?
The story of our convention is about hope. It's about progress and it's about our vision for the future. We know what we're up against. We know the stakes in November. We've lived through a Donald Trump presidency and we are hell-bent on making sure that we don't live through another one.
Are you trying to reach those audiences then because you feel that those are the votes that you need that are going to help you to get over the line in November?
Definitely. We need every vote. Every vote matters in this election. We know that, you know, even the enthusiasm that's building behind this ticket, it's still going to be a tight race. We're running as underdogs in this fight, so we're going to make sure that we reach audiences and communities all across the country, whether it's on TikTok, Instagram, and we know that each of these creators speaks to a different, unique audience.
Katie Hazeldine there reporting.
So the Paris Olympics are over. The Paralympics are about to begin. The Paris Olympics are widely deemed to have been a great success. And now what could be a political marathon has started. And indeed, President Macron is now asking French politicians from the far right to the far left to embrace an Olympian spirit. No single party emerged with a clear majority from the snap elections in early July, although a new left-wing alliance did come out on top. So how hard will it be to form a new government and choose a new prime minister? We're joined by Bénédicte Pabiot. She's the UK correspondent for France 24. Good morning. Bonjour, Bénédicte.
Good morning. Bonjour, Liz.
Good. So I think it's 6 weeks. This is the longest period that France has never had a head of government after a legislative election. President Macron said, the priority now is to enjoy the Paris Olympics. Is that what politicians have been doing?
Well, we know that, we think we know, certainly the Élysée has let it be known, that President Macron actually wanted to have serious talks with various party leaders on the 19th and 20th of this month. But what happened is that various top politicians said that their holidays, they were on holidays. And to many people, that will seem not so surprising. But yes, it's been 6 weeks since French voters turned out in force to vote in the snap legislative elections called by President Macron. And France still doesn't have a government. Or rather, Lise, it has the same one. The same cabinet led by the same Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal, occupying a caretaker role, and that is despite resigning after a leftist alliance beat Macron's coalition to win the most seats in Parliament. So, yes, there's been the Olympic truce, but no gold medals for the speed in which this, some call it procrastination, and there has been some criticism. There's this famous saying that the French president is le maître des horloges, the master of the clock, whether he's playing prolongation. But so there were some talks yesterday with leaders of the left-wing coalition. They came out seemingly happy, thinking that they had passed their message that they wanted very much Lucie Castet, this technocrat, 37 years old, no experience in politics, to be their candidate and to become the prime minister. But there are more talks on Monday with Marine Le Pen and Jordan Bardella from the Rassemblement National. And could we get white smoke on Monday evening?
So, but the allies of President Macron after the election said nobody won, underlining that they say it's not just a question of numbers. Yes, this new, this left-wing alliance came out on top, but now they're saying it wouldn't be stable. What are the arguments by President Macron's team?
The reason that those critics are saying it wouldn't be stable is because what you've got is, although you're absolutely right, the left-wing NFP won the most seats in the 577-member National Assembly. They got 182 seats. It was followed by Macron's centrist alliance Ensemble Together with 168, so really not a big difference. And then in third, surprisingly, not predicted by the polls, Le Pen's National Rally and its allies, they came third with 143 seats. And none of these people want to work with each other. So President Macron keeps on saying, look, yes, we've had Olympic truce. Now it's time to really forge ahead for a broad coalition. But the fact of the matter is that, for example, although that left-wing alliance came out on top, there is real criticism, opposition to the France Unbowed hard left party. For example, Gabriel Attal, head of Renaissance, says that he will call a vote of no confidence in the French parliament were any members of the France Unbowed party to be in government. And they've all got really different policies. So there is a real political stalemate, a deadlock, and it's very hard to see. We believe that President Macron will take to the airwaves on Monday evening, but to say what? To announce the name of a new prime minister? And can, given this political stalemate, can there be stability? There's a vote that is, there's one thing that can't be changed, and that is that the budget needs to be voted by early next year. And how will that happen? Will there be enough stability? Far from clear at the moment.
So what kind of impact is this having on daily life, or is everyone focusing on les vacances, the vacation?
Well, people are trickling back. Yes, it is a very big French phenomenon that in July and August, let alone now with the very successful Olympics and the Paralympics about to start, that people have been, there's been a truce in every sense of the word. Some people have even suggested that the man that led the Olympics should actually be the new prime minister, that goodwill and organizational skills would be much needed. That doesn't seem to be on the cards. But of course, la rentrée is a very big phenomenon. In France, and people come back from the beaches, from their holidays. And I think the overwhelming majority of people, the population, want, obviously, a government that is going to be stable and to know, you know, that things and big decisions are being made. And at the moment, no huge decisions can be made because this is an outgoing government that is démissionnaire. So it's not allowed to make big decisions.
We will watch with interest. Bénédicte Babiot, thank you very much.
It's very interesting, the psychology of Olympic Games. Because I remember, you get the euphoria when your city is not named.
Oh.
You then get the years of grumbling and fighting as the budget keeps going up and up. The budget for the London Games was originally $3 billion and ended up at $9 billion. And then everyone says, oh, nothing's going to be ready on time. Everyone's very pessimistic, which is what the French were about it. Then it happens, it all goes well, and everyone says, what a wonderful thing. And everyone says, and now we have to look forward to, of course, the Paralympics, which start on Wednesday, I believe, of next week. Today, however, we're going to see the lighting of the Paralympic flame at Stoke Mandeville Hospital to recognise that hospital's legacy as effectively the birthplace of the Paralympic movement. Baroness Tanny Gray-Thompson, one of Paralympics GB's most successful athletes of all time, will be making a speech at the lighting ceremony today and joins us now. Tanny Gray-Thompson, fascinating. I had no idea that Stoke Mandeville is seen as the birthplace. How so?
So Sir Ludwig Guttmann was a German Jew and he escaped Nazi Germany, came to Stoke Mandeville, where he was asked to look after a huge number of patients who'd been injured in the war. And he used sport as a tool to rehabilitate them. At that point, if you had a spinal cord injury, your life expectancy was between 2 and 5 years. You mostly died from pressure sores. You rarely left hospital. But they didn't have enough bed spaces to do that. So Ludwig decided, you know, actually people should be sporty. And out of that grew an initial sports competition, which was just for wounded soldiers. And then it expanded. So what we now call the first Paralympic Games was 1960 in Rome, and it's grown from there.
Okay, fascinating stuff. And looking forward to this Paralympics, who should we be excited about?
Oh, God, there are so many athletes across different sports. Alona Whitfred is the youngest swimmer on the squad at 13. Dave Weir, who's been a stalwart of athletics. Sarah Storey, who is Britain's most medalled Paralympian.
Well, her story is amazing, isn't it? I may ask, how old is she now?
46.
Okay.
Started as a swimmer. She was in Barcelona. I think she was 14 just. And then moved to cycling because she couldn't swim because she had an ear infection. Actually, I think cycling was the sport she was meant to do. So the couple of Paralympics she did swimming was just a precursor to cycling for her.
Just a loosener. Yeah. And apparently she's still committed to doing LA as well.
Yeah, girl. I mean,
she'll be, if it's not impolite, yeah. She'll be 50 by then. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you've got the will and the spirit to keep going, why not? But I retired quite a few years before that.
Yeah, for those people who might be new to the Paralympics, it takes some getting used to because there are different disabilities, there are different classes, there's your T38s, your S14s. Can you kind of simplify it for us a little bit, how it kind of works?
So the classification system was put in place to enable fairness because the impact of each impairment on the sport is very different. So it's basically to ensure that there's a fair competition and there's a lot of work that goes behind the scenes to make sure the athletes are put into the right class.
Okay. And just there's been some disquiet about the number of unsold tickets. Is that a worry? What do you make of that?
Do you know, I think, you know, Tokyo, nobody came to watch. You know, Rio, they really struggled to sell tickets. Actually, there were days they sold more tickets for the Paralympics than the Olympics. I mean, they've sold a couple of million. So there will be a lot of people there watching. Also, I think as we get closer, then, you know, there's going to be more enthusiasm and all the Parisians who, you know, leave for the holidays will be coming back. So... Mm. I think the venues will be in pretty good shape.
Yeah, as we were just hearing, people begin to trickle back into Paris from the Les Vacances. And I suppose one of the other things is that the interest in the London 2012 Paralympics, London set the bar quite high.
Oh, yes, they did. And that's, you know, in part because Seb Coe was the chair, and then you had Paul Dighton, who was the chief exec, and they sent out a very strong message of, you know, equality for the games. It was same look and feel. And, you know, that was amazing to see. And spectators came out in droves. You know, the venues were absolutely packed. You know, Rio, when they bid for the games, were in a better financial position than when they had to deliver the games than obviously with COVID. So, you know, it's been a tough couple of years for the games. We think Paris will be pretty close to London in terms of look and feel.
And... Tony, this is Lise Doucette now joining in. I wonder whether, you know, just beyond the Olympics, the Paralympics, do you find there is more support being given to Paralympic athletes in their training and in the run-up and then afterwards?
So in the UK, we've been really lucky. So Olympians and Paralympians get lottery funding if you get to a certain level. And that absolutely helps them achieve the medals that we've seen and that we're going to see. In other countries around the world, it's not the same. And this is the first time there'll be really serious coverage in the USA, which is fascinating because they've had scholarships at universities for disabled athletes for 50 years. Their you know, American disabilities legislation is really strong, but they've never quite connected to the Paralympic movement. So I think if they do that, that's when we're going to see the games hit a really sort of, we're going to see global superstars, I think, coming out of these games in a way that we perhaps haven't before. But, you know, in terms of sponsorship media coverage, we're not at an equal point yet, but, you know, it grows slowly every year.
Of course, you have the Invictus Games, Prince Harry, and
just we've got about a minute left, Tani. What are the most exciting events that you think? You know, we think if there's one event you don't think we should miss, which would it be?
I probably should say athletics because that was my sport. Wheelchair rugby. I mean, it is full on contact. It's brilliant. You know, the American team are looking to
sounds
to win
dangerous.
It's there is a level of, that's what makes it exciting to watch. So. Yeah, rugby's going to be one that, yeah, switch on the TVs for that one.
Okay, and I'm just looking down the list here of Johnny Peacock, of course, who went on to Strictly fame. He's going again.